Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Craig
and Matt.
Big time Fight Night card on the way. Coming up this weekend, UFC Holloway taking on Rodriguez. As always, one half of your hosting duo away from home this week, Craig Allen FNP. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP, my name, and then Fight Night Picks at the end of it. Same thing for Matt Allen, the co-host. He is with me to my fictional left, but also to your right at Matt Allen FNP. Now, Matt, we had an amazing run last weekend. We had some of the best fan interaction we've ever had on the channel.
I'm sorry, Chris. Why limit us to last weekend? We've been doing great for a minute now, and I feel like this is the chance to pat ourselves on the back.
Listen, it was absolutely on fire. I went 12-2. You went 11-3, but the results notwithstanding, we had an amazing weekend with the fans because on Question Mark Kick, 7 big-time guests. We got to shout them out. We got to give them props. We got to say our thanks. Clint from the Die Hard MMA podcast, Mike Heck from MMA Fighting, Kristen King, you can find her with Bloody Elbow, among other websites. Who else do we have? JHK, fresh
Aaron
off his
Bronstetter?
Stint. Yeah, Aaron Bronstetter. I mean, we had so many great guests on the show, so I just want to shout them out right there. It was so much fun having everybody participate, and it was my favorite episode of Question Mark Kicks we've ever had. And then we also had the Fight Companion. It was loads of fun and a wild night of fights. Obviously, Gaethje Chandler was insane. If you want to check out some reactions, maybe go back and watch that Fight Night Picks Companion. But also, the fight after that, Burgos Quarantillo, was great. And really, and I had to think of it, we're going to have a fight similar to that. If you like that fight, Burgos Quarantillo, Song Yadong's got a big fight coming up against Shane Burgos' teammate, Julio Arce. So many good fights on this card, Matt. Again, I couldn't be more excited because up at the top, Max Holloway's fighting Yair Rodriguez on regular TV. What? That's insane.
Like any good party, there's always a bit of a come down the next day. You know, you always feel a little rough. And after the last 2 weeks we've had, this card feels like a bit of a come down. But that's only because we've had two of the better pay-per-views in recent memory back to back as cards. And like you said, this main event is as good as any Fight Night main event you can possibly get. This is like pay-per-view co-main event material. This is like one of those fights where if it was on the main card of a pay-per-view, everybody would be asking for it to be 5 rounds, even though it would probably be like the opener. You know what I mean? Like, this is just one of those entertaining fights where I don't care if you barely like MMA, you're still going to be excited about this fight. When Max Holloway fights, it's like a viral sensation at this point. And for Yair Rodriguez, he was going to be like the cash cow for the UFC. He was that next golden boy for them. It hasn't really worked out. Just kind of been a weird career trajectory for Yair Rodriguez. But we all know what he brings to the cage on his absolute best day. I couldn't be more excited for this fight.
Rodriguez hasn't fought in about 2 years since he rematched with Jeremy Stephens. Obviously, the first fight was ended under awful circumstances. Brennan Fitzgerald had to end up under a table. So, Matt, I'm really looking forward to this card. Let's throw it on over to our Fight of the Night screen, as always presented by Manscaped. So hard to choose on this card. Make sure you check out the sponsor, manscaped.com. Use promo code FNP. You're going to get 20% off your order and free shipping. It's a Fight of the Night screen.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the Fight of the Night with Fight Night Picks.
So when we're talking possible Fight of the Nights, I know in the intro I highlighted the fact that Song Yadong is going to be taking on Julio Arce. That's the people's Fight of the Night. That's the one that really I'm going with, but I'm going to give you two extra fights here just for fun. We're going to mix it up, Matt. Kalen Chaos, the Ox Fighter Williams, a guy who has about umpteen different names, is going to be taking on Miguel Caramel Thunder Bison. I feel uncomfortable saying that nickname. A guy this white and pasty shouldn't be saying that. However, Matt, these are two of the most exciting strikers at 170 pounds. And if we get an ounce of wrestling in this fight, count me as surprised.
Okay, you know how we always say, like, when John Vellante fights, like, what does he have over Dana White? It's kind of the opposite with Miguel Baeza. Like, why does Dana White hate him? In his first 3 UFC fights, he will have fought, ready, Matt Brown, Takashi Sato, Santiago Ponzinibbio. Those are his first 3 UFC bouts. Now we're adding Chaos Williams, one of the most dangerous punchers in the division on top of that. Like, Miguel Baeza is in the trenches right now, early on in his UFC debut. It's kind of like a rookie gets drafted to a really good team and they're just kind of thrown into the fire immediately. That's kind of been the Miguel Baeza run so far. And yeah, his fights have been really entertaining, but he is an uber prospect. And I think this is a really, really fun fight.
Miguel Baeza, the Spencer Knight of Southern Florida MMA to Southern Florida hockey. Let's get into it, hockey fans. And for Chaos Williams, we've seen a more subdued fighter his last couple of fights out there against Pereira, and then when he took on Matt Semelsberger. So ultimately, a good fight nonetheless. And then, of course, how could you not go with the main event? I mean, two of the most dynamic strikers in this division. And listen, fight of the night doesn't always have to be between a couple of strikers. It just so happens this weekend that that's what we're going with. But Max Holloway taking on Yair Rodriguez of Valley Flow Striking Systems, whatever gym is the flavor of the month for Rodriguez. I see him training with a lot of different dynamic fighters. Seems like Tecco's going to be kind of in and around that one. Old Jose Alberto Quinones, you know him as that guy that lost to Sean O'Malley. But Matt, when I look at this fight, it is definitely an amazing one for Max Holloway. His last performance, some would say performance of the year.
Oh, okay. Hand it off to me on that. Yeah, it really could have been. What he did to Calvin Kattar was absolutely awful to watch after like the third round. And he just kept on getting better and better and better as the fight goes on. It's kind of that Piotr Jan mindset where it's like, okay, you better beat me round one because I guarantee you it's going to get harder and harder and harder as it goes on. So if you lose the first round, just imagine how bad that fourth and fifth round are going to be. Here's the other thing about Max Holloway. He likes to talk when he's in the cage. Oh, I'm the best boxer in the UFC. I wonder if we're going to hear him say, that was for BJ Penn. Because he's fighting to defend the honor of a Hawaiian right now against Yair Rodriguez. That was one of the most disgusting main events we've ever seen in UFC history. And here's the thing for Yair, or for Max, sorry. He doesn't really have to take this fight right now. Like, most people believe he is the number one contender anyways, and that this is just sort of like busy work for him. So how fortunate are we that in Max Holloway's spare time, he felt the need to fight Yair Rodriguez just for our entertainment?
Defending the honor of future governor of Hawaii, BJ Penn. Matt, is that how he puts bills into office? What does he do? I can't wait for these fights. We have so many good ones on this card that you're not going to want to miss. Make sure you check out our sponsor, Manscaped, at manscaped.com. Matt, they've got all sorts of great products out there. What have you got around you? Anything good?
I've got the brand new shampoo and conditioner in one hand, and I've got the body wash right here too. Make sure you check out some of those new products. I've got all of my stuff in the bathroom, and I'm not going to run and grab it. Some of the ball deodorant, you know what it is. I'm not going to do the actual practice test like Craig does on camera.
I don't know what I do on camera, but make sure you check them out. Fight of the night, as always, so many good ones out there, and a big time card. So it has been a wild, what, Matt, like 2 months for Fight Night Picks. The results have been insane. The fan participation has been insane with question mark kicks. It's always live 2 hours before the prelims. The QMK parlay, since I brought them back, I was down in the dumps. I went 0 for 2, and then I took a number of weeks off. But we got three. Three have been right all in a row since I brought them back. And last weekend, it was a three-legger, so a pretty fun one there. Make sure you check out the show 2 hours before the prelims. We're going to be going live on Saturday. And listen, it's a road game for me this week. But again, I couldn't be more excited about the fights. If you can't get enough of Fight Night Picks, maybe you check out our second channel. It's called 50-Minute Card Breaks. We just had a video drop this past weekend where we cracked open a couple of blaster boxes of UFC Chronicles, some big-time rookies, and a lot of the same fighters picked up in those boxes. But make sure you check that out if you're a fan of the trading card industry. You can also find episodes of Early Stoppage here on the channel. Another Inside Baseball, John Franklin and I most likely taping one the middle of this week. So we'll have one out before the end of the week. But all sorts of great stuff going on with Fight Night Picks. If you haven't tossed us a like or a sub already, please do so because it just really amps things up heading into quarter number four for Fight Night Picks. Matt, I can't wait for this fight. I mean, listen, you look at this. Unranked heavyweights in the co-main event, that usually doesn't work out all that great. We had Andre Arlovsky, Carlos Felipe a few weeks ago in that co-main event slot. But you look at this one already. Ranked fighters Holloway, Rodriguez, Yadong, Moises, Calvillo, Lee, Felipe Lin's OSP was just canceled. But maybe Felipe gets another opponent. I don't know. It's going to be a good one. I'm really looking forward to it. So Matt, as we always say with Fight Night Picks,
let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up at light heavyweight this weekend. We have a parlay buster, Matt. Kennedy Nzechukwu coming out of Fortis MMA. Only one blemish on his record to the ranked submission specialist, Paul Craig. He's going to be taking on an interesting fighter out of Phil Collins' favorite fighter in MMA, Saida It's Da Eun-jung. And Matt, for Da Eun-jung, this is a fighter where I thought I had the code cracked. I thought I had this guy figured out. He pumps the jab out there like it's going out of style. And listen, this is going to be a generalization, but out of fighters at Korean Top Team and one of his main training partners in the Iron Turtle, you look at the way that these two guys fight, very similar. And I said that for his teammates' fight here, what? Was it a couple of weeks ago when he took on Gregory Rodriguez? Yeah. Pumping that jab out there one, two, three times. Really good boxing in and out so well. And if we have to mix in wrestling, wow. Well, I can do that too. But the weird thing is for Da Eun-jung, the wrestling wasn't necessarily always a focal point of his offense. And you look at this guy, he's undefeated since 2015. He's won 13 straight fights. He has a win over Hulk. Go look that guy up. Former professional wrestler and mixed martial artist. His losses, I mean, his last loss was to Roky Martinez in 2015. Like, that's how crazy Da Eun-jung's overall career has been. But in the UFC, Matt, it's been filled with, do I want to say ups and downs? I mean, it's mostly ups and one down, but you look at it so far in his UFC career, he submits Hadis Ibrahimov 2 years ago. He knocks out Mike Rodriguez with a right cross. He has a split draw against Sam Alvey, and then he comes out his next fight against William Knight. Now, it was, listen, the boys from Fight Night Picks were wrong that night. He went out there and wrestled William Knight, who's a pretty darn good wrestler in his own right. And Da Eun-jung looked amazing in that fight. Matt, I wrote down the scorecards from MMA decisions on that one. There were 4 30-25s. There was 10 30-26s. There was 1 30-27. Da Eun-jung was on so much that night. And again, I want to give credit where credit's due because I mentioned the Iron Turtle, Jun Young Park. But the guys that he's training with right now, Si Yun-jung and Dong Jin Ha, are a couple of the guys over there that are really putting things together. Matt, Korean Top Team, again, I get it. Jun Young Park lost the other week. He was looking good until he didn't, but they're really putting it together over at that gym. But when I look at this fight, again, my mind tells me Da Eun-jung's going to win this fight. And then I look at what Kennedy and Zetchiku has been able to do in his last fight. You want to talk about war of attrition? He's getting beat by Carlos Ulbrich hard in the first round. And then he comes right back because Carlos Ulbrich had no cardio. And then in his last fight, he's taken on, just hear me out, he's taken on Danilo Marquez, where he's in every single bad grappling position you could be at, of a guy that corners tons of fighters, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, black belt, like the guy. And we thought, oh, A, Carlos Ulbrich's going to win. But B, well, surely Danilo Marquez is going to submit Kennedy and Zetchiku. Nope. Not whatsoever. And in the later stages of that fight, oh, Kennedy turns it on again and gets another finish. Like, Matt, we have to finally give Kennedy and Zetchiku his flowers. And you talk about guys that seem like the nice guys in MMA. And Zetchiku, I mean, listen, for caring with for his mother with ALS to kind of putting his career here and there on the back burner, like, and the way that he speaks and comes across, he seems like one of the nicest guys going.
Yeah, he really does. Now, I agree with everything you said, but I hate the way you framed it. This is the thing. It's not like Ulbrich just got tired and that's why Kennedy won that fight. It was the pressure of Kennedy, which really chipped away at Carlos Ulbrich. Like, I really think it was more of what Nzechku was doing well and less of what Ulbrich did poorly in that fight. Because yes, Carlos Ulbrich moving forward is a handful and he's got great technique and he's very flashy with his strikes. But just pressure beats a lot of that stuff. And we see it in MMA all the time. You need distance to get off all those flashy strikes. And Carlos Ulbrich needed distance in that fight. And once Kennedy was able to crash forward, make it an ugly fight, he was able to land absolute bombs.
Which is so strange for a guy at 6'5 with 83 inches of reach to have to crash distance. And I know even watching his Contender Series fights, Matt, before I hand it on over to you, the big thing was, can he get that fire? Can he get that killer instinct? Because he's been so reserved, especially the first Contender Series fight. And then as soon as he lets it go, he usually closes distance, throws a big right hand or a head kick. And it's like, wow, this guy's really special.
Yeah, he's like Uriah Hall, kind of, where when he's aggressive and when he's on, there's barely anybody who can beat them. And it really does feel like it is kind of the mindset switch. Now, the difference is Kennedy can win fights even without the knockout or without the stoppage. With Uriah Hall, he kind of relies on that stoppage a little bit too much. Like, there's not a lot of Uriah Hall unanimous decision wins out there because he is so reliant on that one strike capability. But with Nzechku, he can win just based off of his volume numbers. And the thing about
there's
this
only
fight
three
is
of them.
What?
There's only three decision wins. I just want to say that. And I mean,
I
two of them
Craig,
were in his first three fights.
He's only got 9 wins. How many more decision ones do you want? Really? Yeah, a third of his wins are by decision. Like, a third of them are by knockout, and a third of them are by submission. What? I don't get why that's a knock. That's a really good thing to have. That's what I like out of Nzechko. He doesn't just have to rely on the finish, because he does have really good output, especially for this division. And we saw that in his last fight. I don't know why you're shaking your head. His two fights ago was a great example. He's got good pressure because he can use it to beat fighters who don't have good cardio. Not sure what all the head shaking was for. This is the thing that I think is going to be really important. If Kennedy can dig underhooks immediately in this fight, similar to what we saw Alexander Volkov able to do against Marcin Tybura over and over and over again, he might be able to win this fight just based on height and physicality alone. Because with Dalian Jung, he's not the type of wrestler who's going to go out there and really chain as much together as he will just put his force on top of you. Like, he makes you feel his takedown attempts. It's not a lot of that pretty stuff, Daniel Cormier, Derek Lewis, where it's like, okay, I'm going to feel your shoulder, go for the ankle pick. It's a lot of that, oh, I'm going to get you up against the cage. You're going to feel my physicality. I'm going to go down, shoot for the two legs, pull them out, and really make you feel my pressure. Against a guy like Kennedy, I think that's a really hard game plan, honestly. With his size and with his reach, especially in this division, I think he's going to be able to at least get big numbers early in the fight. Now, does that mean he's going to be able to win it 10 times out of 10? No, but I think that if he can just stay on the back foot and not be the aggressive fighter we've seen in his last two performances, but sort of let the fight come to him and just let his hands go naturally, I think he can have a really good opportunity to win this fight.
So the odds for this one, Matt, Daun Jung open a minus 225 favorite. He's a minus 127 right now. For Nzechko, open a plus 188. He's a plus 104. If we have a look at Tapology, again, those odds, I didn't actually write them down for this one. So I'm going on the flow. I have no idea what they actually are. The Tapology votes for this one, Matt, 843 total votes, 51%. Nzechko, 19% by decision, 72% by knockout. For the 49% that have Jung, 70% by decision, 19% by knockout. The reason I shook my head earlier, 2/3 of Kennedy's wins, 6, are by knockout, 1/3 are by decision. I wouldn't say he's a big decision fighter, especially
if he had one more decision win, we'd be saying half his fights are almost by decision. It's the numbers.
His one decision win in the UFC should have been a loss, but listen, nut shots were getting handed out like, I don't know, cotton candy at a fair against Darko Stuzic, and that's the reason why he won. He knew he shouldn't have won that fight, and he kind of talked about it after the fact. It was kind of awkward, but still, I just wouldn't go with that narrative. I think for Kennedy, you're right. He's one of those guys that does have staying power, especially later on in a fight, and he's the type of light heavyweight that definitely can conserve himself very well. Hear me out. Daun Jung's a cardio king. He hits the point, but he can hit to finish as well. And I think he's the more well-rounded fighter in a matchup like this. For those reasons, I really do like Saeda, and I'm going with Daun Jung in this fight.
I agree with the well-rounded fact or point. It just, I don't think he excels enough at anything to really go out there and put it on Nzechko. Like, of his A-level skills, I would say the majority of Daun Jung's are kind of B level. I wouldn't say he does anything at the C level. I would just say he's very well-rounded at everything. And for me, I think he's going to have to use the takedown, kind of like we saw Frankie Edgar use against Marlon Vera in their fight. Early on in that fight, when he is able to mix in the takedown with his punches, he's going off. It looks like former champion Edgar again. We could see a similar performance from Daun Jung where he's looking really good.
Kick.
Well, okay, we're probably not going to see that. But if he is able to mix in the takedown, especially early, and start to wear on Nzechko, Kennedy won't be able to get off to a really big lead with his volume. I just think with his footwork and with his build, it's going to be really hard for Daun Jung to get on the inside of Nzechko. And that's why I think he's going to be able to win this one.
Big time fight coming up for Jung. Went 2 of 3 in the first round against Knight in takedown attempts, 3 of 3 in the second round, and 3 of 3 in the third round. It makes it for an interesting contest. But Matt, you and I are split on this pick. You have the man himself, the African Savage, Kennedy Nzechko, big time fighter at light heavyweight. I'm going with South Korea's Daun Jung. And I could have mentioned an elevation joke in there earlier because you said he didn't have any C-level qualities. But Matt, this is going to be an awesome fight on a great card. Max Holloway take on Yair Rodriguez in the main event. You're not going to want to miss this. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say,
let's get into it.
Listen, Matt, I don't know if when the UFC thinks of Mark Jacasey, they think of that Drake song and they go, Jacasey, do you love me? Will you fight with me? Are you ever going to fight again? I want you and I need you, but you've been away. Like, when I look at Mark Jacasey, Matt, he's one of those fighters that really got on the map at the perfect time. We had Conor McGregor hitting his peak. Fighters from, listen, Western Europe, they were popping off. And Mark Chiesa was able to come into the UFC, capture lightning in a bottle, and then lose three fights in a row, all the hype that he had, not compete all that often, sometimes fit himself into Drake lyric wordplay. And now he's taking on Rafael Alves coming up this weekend in a fight that is incredibly dynamic. It should be a very exciting fight. It just doesn't feel like a fight that really reaches anywhere near the surface or the peak for the Bone Crusher. And I look at his overall game. He's a guy that spent time at a number of different gyms. And for this one, just in case anybody wanted to know, from the Instagrams, it looks like Mark Chiesa has been training at All Stars Training Center with Alexander Gustafsson. And you might say, like, you might go, oh, well, hey, Alexander Gustafsson trains there, but there's no way, you know, a lightweight's training with a light heavyweight, sometimes heavyweight. No, they are training together. And of course, Khamzat Chimaev, he's also training with Muslim Salikov at UFCPI in the past week, getting ready for this fight. But I wanted to give credit where credit is due, because I've seen Coach Salman Berisha over there training with some of those guys. And I mean, he did a great job with Khamzat, getting him ready for his last fight against Li Jingliang. Obviously, with Mark Chiesa, nowhere near the same fighter as Khamzat Chimaev. But what we have seen over the progression of Chiesa's career, I don't know if it's kind of been his time in American Top Team in the past, he's become a little bit of a wrestler. What do you make of that?
It's been a really interesting career for Mark Chiesa. And it feels like right now he's in his last week in Orlando version of Aaron Gordon of his career, where you know him for the highlights and you know him for the craziness of the peaks. Like, when I think of Mark Chiesa, I can't get that knockout shot of Teemu Pakalin out of my memory. Like,
that's recently retired, happy trails.
One of the most clean knockouts you will ever see in MMA, though. Just the way that he's able to throw the overhand, use his feet to set it up. Like, when you think about Mark Chiesa, he's another one of these guys where if we just want to focus on the plus skills, I could sell you a package that makes it seem like he's a top five fighter. But it seems to be a lot of the intangibles and a lot of the in-betweens that he does sort of struggle with. And it has been unfortunate, because if you even go back to, like, the Dan Hooker fight, I know that was one of the early ones on in his losing streak, but, like, losing to Dan Hooker is not that big of a deal, especially by submission in the third round of what was a fairly competitive fight up until that point. And that's what you sort of have to remember when you think about Mark Chiesa and his losing streak. He lost your car close in a really close fight, no pun intended, where he did break his foot early in that and couldn't really throw kicks. Then he loses to Dan Hooker, who's one of the top 10 lightweights in the world. And then he loses to Nasrat Haqparast. Now, I will say that Haqparast loss was a really bad one, where Nasrat's able to get on the inside of his punching capabilities and just throw a lot of boxing combinations and really overwhelm Chiesa. And that was sort of the first fight where I jumped off of the Chiesa hype train, if you will. I thought, okay, three losses are kind of different depending on what fighters, you know, get those losses and where they are in their career. But I thought we had kind of seen, I guess we'd already seen the best of him, but that wasn't the case at all. And it really has been unfortunate these past few years with him being so inactive, because I really do feel like post Joe Duffy, we saw Mark Chiesa make a turn. He has become a more well-rounded MMA fighter. He throws more elbows now on the inside. He's not somebody who can get their distance, just completely crash, and then he has no offensive tools. Like, he has started to grow as an MMA fighter, like you mentioned, adding in his wrestling as well, but it still feels like we're being sold that fighter who has all those highlight reels where he's evolved quite a bit.
So let me go from that and what you said there. I mean, in the fight against Lando Venata, it was Mark Chiesa getting 4 of his 7 overall takedowns, 5 minutes and 8 seconds of control in that fight. Lando Venata is not an easy guy to control on the ground unless you're a super, super wrestler. So a good job by a striker getting a guy who's so shifty like Lando Venata down and beating him that way. Now against Fiziev, you might say, oh, okay, well, he lost to one of the more dynamic strikers. But in that fight, he went 0-4 in takedown attempts, and he actually got taken down by Fiziev. Now, the first round wasn't necessarily all that close. Second round, third round, quite close between those two guys. So it was a fun fight. It was also, and I could cue it up, one of our biggest missteps with Fight Night Picks and the reasons why we never, ever say lock of the night. Check out Manpreet. He's got a great channel about that kind of stuff. But we were all over Chiesa in that fight. We got proven wrong. So, Matt, we talked quite a bit about the Bone Crusher. Let's talk about Rafael Alves. This is a guy that he had a fight on Dana White's Looking for a Fight, and I wrote it down. It was a very, very long time ago. In 2019, it was a Titan FC card where Jason Soares took the cake because him and his manager went backstage, tried to get Dana's ear, and Dana's like, no, now you're not in the UFC ever. Good job. But for Alves, they said, okay, we want to bring you on. We want to bring, you know, give you some time, bring you on to Contender Series. And then he didn't fight for a year and a half. And he went on Contender Series, and he got kind of roughed up a little bit, and then he finishes the fight, and then he's supposed to make his UFC debut back in February against Pat Sabatini. And for a fight at featherweight, Matt, leading up to that fight, we said Aljovic is one of these guys. Yeah, he's a featherweight, but he's more so a lightweight, and he's a big, big guy. He weighed 157.5 for a featherweight fight. He missed the lightweight limit trying to make featherweight. So they decided, okay, we're going to give you, you know, a good fighter, somebody that, you know, might be a little bit of a sleeper at 155. He gets Demir Ismagulov. And in that fight, I have the numbers, Matt. First round, 68-4 total strikes in favor of Ismagulov. 4 minutes and 46 control time for him as well. Round number two, 50-12, the total strikes for Demir Ismagulov. Third round, 23-20, the total strikes for Ismagulov. But the power went to Aljovic. And Matt, this guy is an absolute wild man. He's the type of guy that looks like a Nick Lentz or like a Brian Kelleher when he gets that guillotine in. He's a defensive submission specialist. He can definitely go, again, reserve, which I think was definitely his issue against Ismagulov, because like once he started blinking, it could have been game over. You never know. But for Aljovic, he just really needs to get into his groove. MMA Masters, big time in the last week or two, because they had Colby Covington last weekend, close enough fight against Kamaru Usman. And then this weekend, they have Miguel Baeza and Aljovic. I think this is going to be a fun fight. But for Aljovic, it's just, what one thing are you going to pull out of your bag of tricks here this weekend?
I feel like you're selling Aljovic a little low, if I'm being honest. He hurt Ismagulov in that fight, and he hurt him pretty bad 100%. At one point. Like, yes, he didn't look good, and with the numbers, it doesn't look great on paper, but I think the performance was a little bit better than the numbers would suggest. He made a pretty good account of himself against one of the better fighters in the division, who not a lot of people know about. Like, you don't go out and parade Demir Ismagulov as a really good fighter because you think he's going to be bad one day. No, you think he's going to be a top-tier talent in this division, just like I do. And if you could have a competitive fight with a guy like that, it means you do belong. But this is the weird thing. With Aljovic, you look at his record, it's kind of salty. He's, what, 19-10? There's a lot of losses on there for a guy who's got less than 20 wins. But
Insert the quote from Dana White here, because that was his big reason for not even really wanting to sign him. It was, this guy has way too much experience. Like, he's a little bit long in the tooth, too.
And I'm going to give you your flowers right now, because he's the opposite of Elias Theodoro. You keep guys like Aljovic because they're exciting, even though their record's bad. And you sometimes cut guys who have really good records, but nobody wants to see them fight. I know it sucks. I know nobody wants to hear that, but this is also the entertainment industry. And that's the thing with Aljovic. He has one of the more like live or die styles in the UFC, although he doesn't get finished very often. The majority of his losses, I guess he's been submitted a number of times, but he does just go for it. And the interesting thing about this fight is, I think there's a path for him to win. Like, if he watched the Nasrat Haqparast fight,
we gotta stop it right here. He doesn't get finished very often. So out of his losses, out of 10 losses, 3 by knockout, 6 by submission, okay, 1 by decision.
So
tonight,
yes,
tonight for records and Matt Allen, I don't know what you're spinning. It's like Miley Cyrus vinyl. It's not like
Craig, don't even get me started. You shook your head the last episode just to agree with me at the end. This is the thing I'm trying to say. With Aljovic, it's live or die. And the thing is, I don't think he's going to lose this fight by stoppage. Like, if Gekasey wins, he's probably just going to style on him, similar to Sean O'Malley, Chris Moutinho, where it's a lot of forward pressure, a lot of that pitter-patter on the back foot, L-step, circle, and get out of the way. I don't think Gekasey's going to want to try to just plant his feet and throw power with a guy like Aljovic, because that's when you let him get back into the fight. The weird thing, though, is when you have a fighter like Gekasey, he relies a lot on his speed and his timing. Those are two things that you get by being active. When you're in the cage, it allows you to stay fresh. It allows you to keep your timing of that kind of in-game speed, if you know what I mean. Like, they talk about that in sports all the time. A guy's been hurt for a while. Oh, they look good in practice, but we just don't know what they're going to look like till it's in-game speed. That's kind of my thing with Gekasey. I always think, there's a fighter in there who could go out there and maybe even beat like an Alexander Hernandez, maybe. Let's say they get matched up. Gekasey hits him with a big shot, knocks him out. We're all talking about Gekasey again. I still think that fighter's in there, and I do think he's going to show that this weekend.
All right, Matt. So the odds for this one, Gekasey open a -220, is a -170 favorite right now on best fight odds. For Aljovic, open a +185. He's a +141 over on Tapology. 780 total votes, 79% Gekasey, 75% by decision. what is it, Alvish, 21% roughly have him to win, 48% by decision, 31% by submission, 14% by knockout. Definitely a world where Alvish can win by submission. So if you like him that way, maybe you want to hedge yourself, go that way. I like Jacasey, like you had said, I like him to win this one by decision. I mean, if you look at it, the sample size for Alvish in the UFC, obviously it's not that big. He has one fight against Ismagulov. So again, his stats are so way down. There's no sense at even looking at that. But if you go back and you watch a lot of his fights on the regional scene, it's just not a ton of output and a lot of really power heavy strikes that are a little bit telegraphed. So for me, I like the guy, like you said, in game speed, little bit of a worry. I mean, it's like when Von Miller eventually comes back to the Rams, what's he really going to look like? Cause he's been out for a couple of weeks. That's a period piece right in time. If you're watching this years down the road, you're going to go, what? Huh? Maybe they win. I don't know. But in this one, I'll go with Jacasey too.
Could you see a world though? And I guess I'll just try to set it up this way. If you see Jacasey with his back up against the cage early, I know I'm going to be really nervous, because if he does get stood upright and if he doesn't have his feet switching stances and trying to be elusive, that's when he is going to get caught with like an overhand left. He's going to shoot for a bad takedown and immediately get choked out. But other than that very specific situation, I do like Jacasey's ability in the open space.
Cross your fingers All-Stars doesn't come up with another Khamzat 2.0, because I don't know if Mark Jacasey can handle it. But Matt, both of us going with England's Jacasey to get the win. Can't wait for this fight and the entire card. Unranked heavyweights in the co-main event, anyone? And in the main, we have your number one contender, Max Holloway, taking on a Mexican wild man, Yair Rodriguez. You're not going to want to miss that fight. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say,
let's get into it.
Interesting fight coming up this weekend at flyweight. We have a 500 record on the line. Cast iron Courtney Casey looking to make the walk, taking on Georgia's Liana Joju. And Matt, I know for a fact, because I've come up against the sea of Liana Joju fans. You're out there, you're watching this video, and if you are, you toss us a like, and maybe we have some nice things to say about her. Or maybe we'll be critical. I don't know. It's early in the video, but Matt, for Liana Joju, it's been a weird ride so far in the UFC. She comes in on short notice. She pops up a weight class. She takes on Sarah Morris of Canada. And in that fight, Morris misses weight. She submits Joju, who I'm sold a bill of goods on as an international master in sports, international master of sports and grappling, UWW. That's in brackets. And this I got from the UFC's Q&A page, but I've read it time and again here and there. So in university, she made her way all the way up to a master of sports and grappling. She is also a UWW world gold champ and bronze champion in grappling. She has grappling in her back pocket. You see that in her fights. That's all I have to say. And later on, I'm going to back it up statistically with what she's done in her three UFC fights. So she loses that fight to Morris, and I go, ooh. Well, Sarah Morris is a 500 fighter in the UFC. And she
not in the UFC, in MMA.
She hasn't looked all that good in the UFC. Okay, so let's move that forward. She fights a Canadian transplant out of Romania in Diana Balbizia. And I go, hey, well, Diana Balbizia is going to win that fight 9 times out of 10. Former KSW champ against a former Fight Nights Global champ. We know exactly how this is going to go, except no, we don't. And Liana Joju looks absolutely amazing in that fight. So then in her last one, they go, okay, you were the hotness against Diana Balbizia. We're going to match you up a few months later against Miranda Maverick in Maverick's UFC debut. And listen, the way that women's MMA and cuts and this and that go in fights is not as lenient as they will go in certain men's fights. I think that goes without saying. You know that. I know that. We all know it. So was that cut on the bridge of her nose that bad? To me, watching on TV, it looked pretty bad, but a lot of people protested on the social medias, as they will. All of this to say, she was losing that fight handily. So she's had a fight against a not-so-good fighter at 135 where she got beaten handily. She had a fight against the, I don't really know where Diana Balbizia is right now at 125. And then she loses to a fighter that, Matt, honestly, I think Miranda Maverick's going to be top five for a while. And she's very young in her career. So that one's fine. For Courtney Casey, on the other hand, though, she has something in common with a former UFC 202 opponent of hers. Yes, Courtney Casey fought Randa Markos on McGregor Diaz 2. She has a salty AF record in the UFC. It's 5-8 in the UFC. But there's two fight of the night spread in there. There's one performance of the night bonus. There's a lot of split decisions. Her wins in the UFC are over Christina Stancio, Randa Marcos, Jag, Jessica Aguilar. She has a split decision win over Angela Hill in a win that ages like fine wine. And her last win was over Mara Romero Barella. 2-3 in the 5 on in. I can go on for days, Matt. But if you look at it for Courtney Casey, training out of a very interesting gym and MMA lab with, of course, Mario Bautista, David Machado, Casey Kenney, Augusto
Dracar
Mendes.
Dracar Close is back.
Guess who's back? Back again. And for Jojua, she trains at a couple of different gyms. I saw Akmat, obviously, on the record. But if you look on her Instagram, Syndicate MMA with a to be retired in her 50th pro fight, Roxanne Modafferi, Joanne Wood. Do you see what I did there? She just got married. Congrats. She dropped the Calder. It's just Joanne Wood now. So awesome to see that for her and John Wood. But Matt, when I look at this fight, Muay Thai background for Liana Jojua. Master of sport in grappling for Liana Jojua. The complete package, some would say. It's just really tricky to gauge what we're going to get in the cage because we haven't seen a good enough sample size for her. And for Courtney Casey, it's just like that I think you should leave reference. When you want a car that doesn't have a big steering wheel that whiff out when you're driving, she's one of those fighters that whiffs at air a lot, and she's a little loud, and that sometimes scores with judges.
So I have to tell this story right before we do anything, just because Jojua's nickname immediately makes me think of this story. I vividly remember us growing up being in the truck with our father and our song coming on the radio. It was a new song by the artist known as Shakira, and it was known as She-Wolf. And I remember the person on the radio go, "This is her first big song after the World Cup one there, the Nani Nani Na." That was a banger. She-Wolf, not so much. They go, "She made this song in 15 minutes. And just instinctively, I said, they play the song. And I went, "Well, yeah, that's not a surprise." And that was one of the early moments in life where I made our father laugh. And that's always stuck with me. So anyways, let's get on to breaking down a fight. If anybody tells you they know what's happening in this, they don't. Because Courtney Casey isn't really a top-level UFC fighter. Now, she has some wins that do age well over time, but I think that's more of a reflection of just how you can kind of win fights in this decision, in this division. We've talked about this a lot. In some lower women's MMA fights, I don't want to say this is a blanket term, but volume can really win. What?
Pump the brakes. Not just in this division, but she's somebody that spent the bulk of her career at 115, moved up. She was always a bigger fighter at strawweight. She's still pretty well a bigger fighter at flyweight too.
Okay, I'm going to let everyone in on a little secret. In a lot of women's MMA fights, they're won by volume, and that's pretty much it, because not a lot of people have one punch knockout power in these divisions. And because of that, in some fights, Courtney Casey is allowed to stay in the pocket and just continue to throw with really no negative implications for her spending too much time in there. Like, look at the Angela Hill fight. If she fought that same way against like Jessica Andrade, do you know what Andrade would do to Courtney Casey? It would be one of the hardest fights to watch of all time. But you get what I'm saying. Against those other volume-based fighters, she can stay in the pocket and have 50-50 exchanges with them. And if you don't have great volume yourself, then she can get away and at least start to put up decent numbers on the scorecard. The other thing that has to be said about Courtney Casey, too, is that she's kind of an underrated grappler off of her back. She can threaten with a lot of submissions, but the problem is she can get just held down. And that's one of those things. I know we both hate this. When a fighter's best skill is kind of hidden behind their worst weakness, which is for Courtney Casey, her submissions off her back are pretty good. Like, even go back to the Michelle Waterson fight. I know she lost that. I know I probably bring that fight up too much, but she looked pretty good off her back in that fight, and she threatened with a lot of submissions in that one. I'm just trying to say, Courtney Casey off of her back can at least threaten with enough submissions to make it uncomfortable for the fighter on top. So the real question in this fight comes down to just how good of a grappler is Jojua? Because here's the thing. There's some numbers to back it up, and they would suggest that she is a very, very good grappler. And I'm going to be here to tell you, though, the eye test leaves a lot to be desired in her overall game.
Red Rover, send the stats guy over. Here we go. So you talked about the fact that Casey ends up on her back. She's able to threaten with a lot of submissions. She has 38% takedown defense in 13 fights in the UFC. That's bad. That's really, really bad. Liana Jojua, now here's the thing. If you go to UFC stats and then they have them like by rank of all time, you have to have a minimum of 5 pro fights in the UFC. Obviously, they're going to be pro fights. What am I talking about? But for Jojua, she only has 3. Morris, Belbizia, and then a middle finger as the third. Whoops.
Wow.
But in her last fight, she loses to Maverick. But here's the craziest thing. She has 66% takedown accuracy through three fights. That's number two behind Valentina Shevchenko at 71.8. Again, bigger sample size, less than five fights, but still paints a good picture. Submission average per 15 minutes, 2.2. That's number one in this division behind, or sorry, I guess behind her would be Montana De La Rosa at 1.12. Negative 2.33 strike differential. That's very, very bad. And that's about all you can say about Liana Jojua. If she has another couple of fights where she keeps up the same pace with her ground game, with her takedowns, then yeah, she could end up vaulting herself into this all-time takedown artist in the division, all-time submission specialist in the division. But as it stands right now, again, very small sample size. So if we have a look at the odds for this fight, Matt, let me bring them up and average them out. For Courtney Casey, she opened a minus 150 favorite. She's minus 207 right now. For Jojua, opened a plus 130. She's plus 168. If we head on over to Tapology, total votes 849, 58% Jojua, 57% by decision, 33% by submission. For the 42% that have Casey, 81% by decision. Matt, this hasn't happened all that lately. This used to be an old occurrence, maybe once or twice a card. This has, honest to goodness, it hasn't happened in a long time. It surprises me that the underdog has an overwhelming bit of support from the public over on Tapology. So are you buying what they are selling on Tapology? Are you going with the fans here? Do you have Georgia's Jojua in this fight?
If this fight was a restaurant, I'd choose not to eat. Put it that way. Like, it's just, I'm not confident in anything on the menu. I'm looking at it right now. It's just, there's a lot that I don't like about this fight, if I'm being completely honest, because there's a world out there where Courtney Casey gets taken down immediately, threatens with an armbar, and it's at least close enough to force Jojua to not just shoot reckless takedowns. And then Casey gets on her feet, just starts slapping leg kicks and jabs, and can look really good in this fight, although it's not against a great opponent. And the flip side is Jojua gets like 15 minutes of top control in this matchup, and we look stupid. I'm going to say this, though. It's similar to my Paulo Costa point. It's all eye test related with Jojua. Her grappling's not great. Like, she's going to get out grappled by top grapplers in this division. Even go back to the Sarah Morris fight. And I know that was up a division, but Morris isn't a UFC caliber fighter, if we're being completely honest. And she was able to just really out muscle Jojua, not only on the mat, but just sort of like she took the fight out of her. And I know people hate it when you say that, but when we say that, like, you sort of question fighters and their mentality. But like, Jojua was on top and immediately just like fell to her back and gave up top position at one point during that fight in the third round. That's not a good sign. We don't want that from championship caliber fighters. We don't expect that from UFC caliber fighters. I think Jojua is going to win this just based on her wrestling offensive. And I think she is a good enough grappler to not get caught by a defensive submission. But even if the stats look really good grappling-wise with Jojua, I don't really think she is like a Mackenzie Dern, Vina Jandihova type in this division.
No, it's just fun to talk about. And I mean, it's like going to a restaurant and you see that they have a twice-baked potato, but then really in the fine print, it says there's a ball of sour cream in there. And you know for a fact that they twice-baked that ball of sour cream. You pop that puppy open, you're going to get the hottest bit of lava cream you've ever had in your life. And if you want quotables this week, I'm giving them all to you. Now, Matt, yeah, when I look at this fight, those numbers are just for fun. They mean absolutely nothing. It's silly. It's stupid. I'm just having fun doing my job. I like Jojua ever so slightly. Again, with that wrestling and the takedown defense of Casey being so suspect, I've seen fighters like Michelle Waterson give her fits on the ground. So for me, I like Jojua up at this weight class with the takedowns. But if you were thinking of putting your money on this fight, either you know something that I don't, or you're just silly. You're just a silly goose. So, Matt, for me, I'm going to be going with George's Jojua. You're going Jojua too. And I don't have any qualms about saying that this is my least confident pick of the week. And the best part about this is there's going to be comments down below, Matt, where people are going to say, we need confident predictions. Just don't go with this fight.
Guys, have some fun every now and then. Listen, there's some fights that are really hard to predict. It's a two-person sport. A lot of things can go wrong. Like, okay, in basketball, if Steph Curry has 50 points, the Golden State Warriors are up by 30 at the end of the game, there's no chance like Jared Allen for the Cleveland Cavaliers could just throw a ball from one side of the court to the other and make up the difference. In MMA, you can do that. Like, Darren Elkins was down 110 points against Wilt Chamberlain, basically, and then got a 110-point dunk against Mirsad Bektic. Like, in MMA, there is that Hail Mary. There is that one-punch KO capability. So some fights are really hard to predict, and this would be one of them.
Matt, big-time fight. Again, both going Joshua. And listen, in the main event, you're not going to want to miss it. Max Holloway's taking on Yair Rodriguez. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say,
let's get into it.
Big-time fight. Coming up this weekend, we have the sniper, Sean Woodson, taking on Michigan's own Colin Anglin. And Matt, I was sold a bill of goods on Colin Anglin in his UFC debut, and I am looking at the receipt and wondering what I got, because he took on Melzik Bogdasari in a fight where I expected just chaining the takedowns. This is a guy that wrestled all the way through. This is a guy, by the way, that took an amateur MMA fight because he just thought it would be fun before even training any type of real martial art and going to an MMA gym. So credit where it's due for Anglin. He is a very, very fun fighter to watch. You want to see some good fights. Obviously, he gets the win over Naimov over on Contender Series, but his knockout win over Frost, his knockout win over Carson, his knockout win over Morgan Sickinger, a guy who had a lot of pro experience. This is a guy who at his core is a very, very well-rounded and fun fighter to watch. It's unfortunate that they gave him to a guy whose nickname is The Gun. And now he goes from The Gun to The Sniper. I'm sure Chris Kyle fans would be excited about this. But Matt, when I look at this fight for Sean Woodson, this is a guy that the one knock on him is, well, he doesn't really control distance all that well for being the biggest guy at featherweight. However, his takedown defense in the UFC has actually been quite good. And if you want to focus on it, he took on a very well-rounded Yusuf Zalal, a guy who I would kind of have in a category maybe, well, he's around these guys. He's not near the top 15. He was on a run at one point. Looked like he was going to go there. But he's kind of, you know, waiting around. I'd say 15 to 30, and that's being incredibly generous. Somewhere in that mix. He can have competitive fights there. But when he took on Sean Woodson for Zalal, he only went 2 of 17 in his takedown attempts. Now, a lot of control time, a lot of that spent up against the cage in that fight. But when Woodson was able to kind of pick his shots and go away, 104 to 55 were the total strikes in that fight. So, Matt, for me, I look at Sean Woodson and everything that he does so well and the work that he does at Wolves Den Training Center, the little bit that he gets in with the Glory Fitness and MMA guys or MMA and fitness guys in that St. Louis region. This guy at his core was a guy that a lot of people were very excited about coming into the UFC with a squeaky, clean, undefeated record, wins in the UFC or no, win on Contender Series over Terrence McKinney, where he's kind of losing that fight until he landed that knee, and then a win in the UFC against Crash Bochniak, and then a loss against Julian Rosa, where he was winning until he wasn't, and then he gets submitted. Matt, in this fight, it's going to be a war of attrition. I can see which guy is going to be able to win a decision.
This is the fight where we find out if Colin Anglin looks like his Tinder profile or if he doesn't at all. Because
Matt,
let's
what
say
does
he
his Tinder
does.
Profile look like? Whoa.
Like a great wrestler. He's got all, like, Colin Anglin right now is like you swiped right on a 9. You've been talking for a couple days. You're going to go get drinks. Everything seems like it's going to go really well. And then you show up and they just like act really weird the whole time. And like, they still kind of look like that person, but just all the personality is not really there. With Colin Anglin, it's like, okay, I know you're great at wrestling. I know you've got great power. You've at least shown the ability to have a really good gas tank in your fights, but you have to show me that at the highest level. And the weird thing about Sean Woodson is, even with a win in this fight, I know we're both going to have question marks about no matter who wins. Even if Woodson wins, we can still kind of point to Anglin and say, hey, he didn't look great against Bogdasari. Maybe he is just kind of a wrestler. Maybe he did lack sort of the ability to mix his martial arts a lot. And even if Anglin wins, we're going to point to Sean Woodson and his just sort of inability to deal with forward pressure in a lot of his fights. So this, I think, could result in a really, really fun matchup. I think this could be fight of the night, sort of buried deep down on the card. But I do find it a really hard fight to predict, because with Woodson, it's really going to matter if he can damage Anglin on the way in. Not so much what happens in open space. I expect Woodson to win sort of the in-betweens or the stagnant moments in this fight, just because he is more of a, I don't even want to say he's more of a volume striker, but he's the more natural striker.
No, he is.
I'm just trying to say, like, he's the more natural striker of the two. So I just expect him to find the holes in those open areas. But where I really expect Woodson to excel at is those in-betweens. When Anglin does try to shoot from far away, that's where I expect Woodson to catch him. It's not just his nickname being the sniper. It is his ability to catch guys on their way in, which is a bit of a double-edged sword, because like we saw with Julian Arosa, if you're not able to land that one big kill shot, if you're not able to submit him on his way in, then pressure will really get to Sean Woodson. And that's, I guess this is the question I'm going to bring it back to you with. I think we both see Woodson, at least in the first round with all of his cardio, as being a potential top 15 guy if everything goes right. My question is, what kind of fighter do you think Woodson is after that first round once his fatigue does set in? Because he does seem to be a completely different guy, and I do seem to worry about him. If things don't go his way in that first round, how is he going to look in the second and third where he's trying to mount a comeback?
I've seen him turn it up in fights. I saw him turn it up against Kyle Bochniak. Round one, round two, round three, he turns up his output against Julian Arosa. That was the one where, okay, it was a little weird. I mean, he turned it up from, what, round one to round two, and then around
three.
That's
my whole thing. If things are going his way, they will always go his way. My question with Woodson is, when the going gets tough, does he also get... It's like Lamar Jackson. You know a lot more about football than me. Lamar Jackson was 0-for-6 with comebacks, but he's got, what, three comebacks in the last, like, three or four games? He's starting to show that. With Woodson, I doubt his ability to come back in fights.
All I care about is when the Browns win and they cover. So listen, big one over the Bengals this past weekend. But Matt, when we focus on this fight, the one thing that I really like about Sean Woodson, and I think this is the most important part of this fight, Colin Anglin might not be the greatest when he gets backed up. Sean Woodson, when he's hitting on the back foot, is incredibly successful. The trouble is he gets held up against the cage, but the other counter to that is he has good takedown defense, and he's one of those guys that people make jokes about it. He understands his length very, very well, and it works out tremendously. It's like watching Neil Magny fight at 145 pounds. That's exactly what it is. He knows that length. He knows that strength. Both guys fight relatively similar. Neil will mix in the takedown a little bit more. He's more adept on the ground for sure than Sean Woodson is, but striking-wise, takedown defense-wise, they can use the cage very well and use that range very well when they need to, and I think pumping those shots up tight up the middle, a very good job there too. So Matt, we won't focus on this one for too much longer, but we have a look at the odds for this one. I'm bringing them up. Sean Woodson, open to minus 300. He's minus 292 right now. Colin Anglin, open to plus 250. He's plus 230 right now. Hazard a guess at the Tapology votes because they're a surprise to us. They are to you. I'm going to say over under 70% Woodson. What would you say?
I think probably over. I doubt a lot of people are impressed after Anglin. Oh,
probably over. I doubt a lot of people are impressed after Anglin.
All of our years. So,
it's probably over. I doubt a lot of people are impressed with Anglin after his UFC debut.
All right. 851 total votes. Matt's yelled in all of our ears. 90% Woodson, 75% by decision for the 10% that have Anglin, 61% by decision. This is something that we don't often do on the show because I write the odds down beforehand. Let's say fight goes the distance. There's three sites that have it. Minus 165. That's a little bit more sexy than picking Woodson to win. But maybe you like the fight to go to decision. I do. I think Woodson's going to win a decision here. I think the volume is going to be a problem. And I think, again, I know how good his takedown defense is. I think Yusuf Salal is a good wrestler. I know Colin Anglin's a very good wrestler, but I do like Woodson in the situation because he's gone up against wrestlers before, not just Salal.
I agree 100%. Again, he's shown that ability to defend takedowns, be able to volume strike against wrestlers too, because that's almost like a weird mental hurdle some fighters have to get past is, do I really want to let my hands go against this wrestler? Because that's when they will shoot on me. Sean Woodson doesn't really show that. Like, he's not afraid to really let his hands go, really believe and trust in his combination. So no, I agree with you 100%. I like Sean Woodson.
Give me a big time promo with like Craig Berube and Colton Pareko. Let's get the Blues involved with Sean Woodson. Let's have some fun with it, Matt. Both of us taking Sean Woodson to get the win. And you're not going to want to miss the rest of this card, including our main event, Max Holloway taking on Yair Rodriguez. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
Absolute banger at 170 pounds. Coming up this weekend, we have Miguel Baeza taking on Chaos Williams. Matt needs a drink. I got to fix my headphones. That's how fired up we are for this fight because both of these guys are Julian Lane style fighters. They come to bang. And for Baeza, that kind of got him caught in his last fight against Santiago Ponzinibbio. It's gotten him caught against Matt Brown, but he finished that fight. And if you look at it for Baeza, again, he was squeaky clean. He was unblemished until he took on Ponzinibbio. But even before that, a big win over Takashi Sato. So, Matt, I look at this fight, couple of guys that have great fighting styles. It makes for that exciting fight. I want to throw it over, though, because for Baeza, he's never really gotten away from that and never really got him in trouble until his last fight. For Chaos Williams, he went with that style and he was able to come into the UFC, knock out Alex Morono, knock out Abdulrazak Al-Hassan. And then he comes around to fighting another wild man in a fight of the night style against Michelle Pereira. But in that fight, they both fight conservatively. And then he comes out in his last fight and fights Matt Semelsberger, and he also fights conservatively. So my problem with this fight is, which chaos do we get? Do I get chaos or do I get Kalen?
The thing is, nobody's beaten Chaos Williams in the UFC except for himself yet. Even the Pereira, like if you look at the Pereira win, you could say that was a close fight. It could have gone either way. I know the 100%. Striking numbers, I think, favored Williams a little bit, but Pereira got a couple of takedowns, but that was a close fight. It was, and like you said, it was awful. Like for those two guys being in the cage, everybody had these crazy high hopes for these explosive strikers. Not a great fight. I thought he looked pretty good against Semelsberger, though, for this reason. At the time, I think that was a weird matchup to make because we thought, at least in our minds, like, okay, Chaos Williams is almost like a borderline top 15 guy other than his last performance. And we didn't really know what to think about Semelsberger up until that point, or at least I didn't. But from at least what my opinion is of Semelsberger now, I think that was a really, really nice win from Williams. And the weird thing about this fight is that I think Miguel Baeza is by far the more technical guy. I think he's the more long-range striker. I think he's the prettier striker, the flashier striker. He has the more, I would just say, ability and technique in basically all of his strikes. My issue is that Miguel Baeza is so hittable. It really does make me worry. And that is something that you can improve upon as you do get older. And he is a younger guy. Don't worry, I'm about to give it to you. But Miguel Baeza, to me, is at this weird point in his career where it's kind of like we saw this newer version of Justin Gaethje, where yes, Gaethje gets into these crazy fight of the nights, but like he's a pretty technical fighter too at the end of the day. With Baeza, if he wanted to steer into that, like I'm going to become more technical, I'm going to throw a beautiful left hook, work on my jab, set things up with my leg kicks, I think he does have that top 15 talent associated with him. What I do question is his ability to just not get dragged into a firefight. That was kind of the story on Dustin Poirier a lot early on in his career, where it was, okay, he's got great boxing, he's got great jiu-jitsu, why the hell does he just go out there and brawl? So for Baeza, I think he's in that same category. If he can stay composed and stay tactical, I think he can beat most fighters in this division outside that top 20 range. But if he does start to get his chin checked more and more and more, like Chaos Williams isn't the guy you want to be testing your durability against in the UFC.
No, and I mean, that's just it. You look at Williams when he came into the UFC and it was like, okay, well, he has wrestling, but he knocks guys out and his striking's a little unpolished, but then he comes in and gets wild flash knockouts in his first two fights. And it's like, oh, okay, threw out everything I know about Chaos Williams. I got to go back to Walmart and buy whatever they're selling now. So then I look at his last two fights and he trained a little bit at Jackson Wink ahead of his fight against Matt Semelsberger. It looks like from the Instagrams, like, I think, did he have a vacation to Mexico? I don't know why he's got so many pictures of Mexico in the last few weeks. And then in his Instagram live from today, or I guess his stories, and we're Monday, November 8th, as we tape this one, he looks like he's training out of Murcielago MMA in Michigan. So who else is around him, Matt? We've got Numansa, Joaquin Buckley. Like, there's a number of fighters around. For Baeza, MMA Masters, like it's always been. The thing that scares you, though, for Baeza, the UFC fights that he's had, he fights Hector Aldana and finishes him. He fights Matt Brown, finishes him. He finishes Takashi Sato. And it's like, okay, this guy's really special. We look at the strikes landed per minute to absorb, significant strikes landed per minute. The average in the UFC right now is 3.33 per minute. Baeza, 5.3 landed to 5.09 received. That's a lot of damage. Like, that's Phil Swift's got Christmas commercials out right now. They should put Miguel Baeza on the side of that putty. And if you look at it for Williams, 5.2 landed per minute to 3.59 received. And in his last two fights, a bit more of a sample size, a bit more of an idea of what this guy can do, because it's not just quick first round knockouts. He's not like Volkan Oezdemir in the cage, like on the way up to a title shot. So Matt, for me, it really is, yeah, who can handle the shot a little bit better? And if and when, who's going to shoot first? Because we've seen Miguel Baeza have success on the ground in the past, not just the second to last fight where he gets a submission win, but this is a guy that if he does need to, and he wants to fight a cerebral fight, he can wrestle. Same for Chaos. I just don't know how well the wrestling defense is going to be. So again, we'll whip through this one, Matt. We'll talk about the odds really quickly. Miguel Baeza opened a favorite at a minus 180. He's a minus 140 right now. For Williams, opened a plus 155. He's a plus 114. Over under on Tapology in terms of the percentages, because I haven't looked at them, Matt. I'm going to set it at 60% Baeza, seeing as he's the favorite. You're going to go over or under?
I think it'll be close to 50-50.
All right, 854 total votes, 67% Baeza, 66% by decision for the 22% have him to win by knockout. For the 33% that have Williams, 21% by decision, 70% by knockout. So the odds have Baeza. The fans have Baeza. You have some trepidations about Baeza, but ultimately, what is the pick here?
I'm picking Baeza, even though every ounce of me doesn't want me to make this prediction, because it is one of those fights where, yes, he's the more polished fighter. Yes, he's the more technical guy. And those are all the things we normally look for. And we normally make our predictions based on the skills that the fighters bring into the cage. But his glaring weakness is Chaos Williams' massive, massive skill. And that's the thing. I do see this being one of those fights where if Miguel Baeza gets overconfident in the pocket, let's say he is teeing off on Williams up against the cage, similar to, and I hate to bring this up, Andre Koroshkov, Douglas Lima, where, oh, I'm doing really good. I'm feeling my volume. I don't mind staying in the pocket for one, two, three strikes too long. And then we see his lights get shut out. So I'm going to pick Miguel Baeza. Although I think this could be one of those fights where he gets like a 10-8 first round, gets a 10-9 second round. We all think he's on his way to a really one-sided decision win. He ends up eating like a left hook overhand right and gets flatlined. So I'll pick Baeza. And I guess here, I'll back it up too, just with this. If you have a fight of the year contender with Santiago Ponzinibbio, there's got to be something special about you. It's like Jeff Green, he was really good in the 2012 finals for the Oklahoma City Thunder. And I really liked Jeff Green a lot after that, because in my mind, it was, hey, you can't be really good in the finals and then really bad in the regular season. With Baeza, he had that big opportunity against a really big name opponent in Ponzinibbio. And he did rise to the occasion. I know he ate a lot of shots in that fight, but he went strike for strike with one of the most dangerous Muay Thai artists in this division. So I do think Baeza will be able to get the win.
And Matt, I think you're really going to like this. For Chaos Williams in his last fight against Semelsberger, he did throw a fair amount of kicks in that one. But Miguel Baeza throws even more, and they're really, really hard. And for that reason, and I like his takedown defense, I just don't think Williams is going to be able to panic into some takedowns, get him down, hold him down. And at the same time, I just think, yeah, both guys have knockout abilities. I've seen more. I've liked more out of Baeza. And again, I'm just going to take Baeza ever so slightly in this fight. And I do want to say that one, because you have a fight that's this volatile, it's got to be popping popcorn all day. But for both of us, Matt, we're going with MMA Masters Miguel Baeza. You're not going to want to miss this fight. It's going to be absolute fireworks. It's going to be fireworks. It should be fireworks. I hope it's fireworks in the main event. More fireworks. Yair Rodriguez going up to challenge Max Holloway, your number one contender. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
I like the way you interesting fight coming up at women's flyweight, because we have a fighter in Cynthia Calvillo just waiting, wishing, and hoping for that 2021 turn that Andrea Lee was able to get for herself, Matt. Because if we look at this one, Lee was a favorite in just about every single one of her fights, and she just really couldn't string it together. Split decision loss to Joanne Lesta Calder. Now it's just Wood. She loses that fight. Then she goes up against Lauren Murphy, loses split decision. Then she fights Roxanne Modafferi, loses the unanimous decision. And then it's like, okay, we're in no man's land. Here's Antonina Shevchenko. And what does Andrea Lee do in that fight? Almost everything right. She really does. She looked very, very good in that one. And you want to talk interesting Instagram games. Andrea Lee, and when I got ready for this fight, and when I got my notes ready, I should say, she's been cross training with so many different fighters at so many different gyms. So I didn't want to just put the gym that she trains at in Texas or the gym that she trains at in Shreveport. I put Scorpion Fighting Systems, where she spent time with none other than Miranda Maverick, getting her ready. So it's just been interesting. You really should check out Andrea Lee's Instagram, because it's just a litany of training partners and very, very high-level women in competitive divisions for her. Same thing can be said for Cynthia Calvillo, Matt. I could not tell you all of the gyms she's trained at throughout her career. I know Team Alpha Male is one of them. I think Colin Oyama trained her for a number of fights. She's been at Extreme Couture for her last number. But the reason why I started this video, Matt, by saying she wants one of those 2021 turns like Andrea Lee was able to have, is because Cynthia Calvillo came at the 125-pound division and blew the doors off and beat Jessica Ai and looked amazing in a main event. And then her last two fights, she takes on Caitlin Chookagian and loses the pop decision. And then her last time out, they went, okay, we'll give you Jessica Andrade. You're going to lose. You're going to lose that one by finish. Oh, by the way, Matt, that fight was a month and a couple of weeks ago. Your thoughts?
Okay, I'm going to pat myself on the back because I made so much money when Andrade fought Calvillo. Like, I was so confident Andrade was going to beat her. I don't know what it was, but it was, if you look at everything Calvillo does really well, it kind of relies on her opponent making a ton of mistakes for her to pull it off. Because the thing about Calvillo is she is this really great grappler. She's got phenomenal submissions, and her transition game on the ground is what makes her really high level. I remember in the Casey O'Neill Antonina Shevchenko video, we made a really big point to bring up the fact that for every martial arts sake, Antonina Shevchenko is at least like an 8 out of 10 in them. Her kickboxing is very good. Her Muay Thai is very good. Her jiu-jitsu is very good, as is her wrestling. It's just that she's not great at all the in-betweens, all the intangibles, all the kind of scrambling, and you know what I mean, just all the ugliness that MMA kind of is. Cynthia Calvillo doesn't struggle with that at all, and that's what Andrea Lee used to beat Antonina. Like, that was the fight that made us all realize, like, oh, Antonina is good if she's in, like, set positions, but if she isn't a scramble, if she isn't one of those, like, weird half guards where it matters whose legs are on top to end up in top position, that's where she struggles. Now, Andrea Lee was able to just kind of use her MMA experience and her overall knowledge to win that fight, but I don't think this is a fight that just your veteran savvy is going to be able to get you over that hump. And the weird thing with Andrea Lee is that she was kind of the original Caitlin Chookagian of the division before Chookagian moved down from 135, because Lee moves on the back foot, pa-pa, throws it with the jab, kind of one of those back foot strikers, if you will, not really an aggressive person to go forward a lot. But Calderwood showed that if you can cut the cage off when you're fighting Andrea Lee, it makes your life a lot easier. If you just follow her around, then yes, she will be able to get the jab off and really tee off with a lot of her volume shots. But if you can corner her and really get her locked down to one spot in the cage, Calderwood was able to use her leg kicks and her elbows to really corner her down. I think Calvillo's just going to use takedown attempts. And the weird thing about that is Calvillo's not this plus wrestler by any means, but what she is really good at is getting you up against the cage, getting you to turn your back, and then she kind of like, she does that Damian Maya, like, I take your back while we're standing up against the cage move. I just, for Calvillo, I think this is just like another warm-up. I know this seems weird, but it felt like the UFC was trying to give her a showcase fight against Andrade only a month ago, and it was like, okay, if you beat Andrade, it's like, well, you've won a main event, which doesn't happen a lot in this division. You won a 5-round contest against the former number one contender. If you could beat Andrade, then we really could have seen like Cynthia Calvillo versus Valentina Shevchenko at one point. And I feel like this is the fight to get her back on that track.
Except she got finished a month and a few weeks ago. That's the thing. Does Andrea Lee have Jessica Andrade power? No, nobody does.
It wasn't a real stoppage, though. This is what I'm going to say. This is what I hate. She didn't get knocked out as much as she gave up and the ref stopped it.
Well, I don't know. The ref just stopped it. She couldn't take any more unanswered shots. But if you turn your head like shots,
she didn't really get hit by a clean shot, though, is my thing. Calvillo,
No, it's fair. You get out volumed. Yeah, and the ref ends the fight. So again, it's not like she got flatlined, she face planted, and now she's coming back way too soon, but it still is a finish loss not that long ago. For Andrea Lee, again, you've got the connection with Miranda Maverick. She trained at Pound for Pound Fitness before her last fight with Tisha Torres and the gang. So it is a really interesting look for Lee with the training partners. Same thing for Calvillo to Extreme Couture. Again, a litany of training partners. Who do we want to pick, Matt? Dan Ige trains there. Who else? Kai Kamaka is a pretty good wrestler.
Your boy Justin Janes, we always bring him up whenever we talk about Extreme Couture.
Good wrestler when he wants to wrestle. So a lot of different people over there. Again, the volume numbers definitely support Andrea Lee in that game. But again, if you want to play the takedown game, 57% takedown defense for Lee, that's an opportunity for Calvillo to take over. Matt, the odds for this one, let me bring them up. Calvillo opened a -150 favorite. She's -120 right now. Lee opened a +130 underdog. She's a -102 or thereabouts on best fight odds. Tapology votes, let me see. 843 of them, 70% Calvillo, 89% by decision for the 30% that have Lee, 80% by decision. Here's my question for you, because I care about who you think is going to win. Do you see a finish in this fight? A, and B, I think Calvillo is some more opportune at finishing this one. So do you think Calvillo is going to be able to finish this fight if you see her winning?
So yes, I agree with your point. If there is a finish, it will most likely be Calvillo finishing Lee. I know Lee is coming off of a finish win over Shevchenko. It was a nice submission. I don't think Adrian Lee can grapple with Cynthia Calvillo at all in this fight, though. With Calvillo, she's not the most dominant of grappler in the sense that okay, if you're in top position, you just can't stay there. It's like hot lava. Oh, just get back up to your feet. She's not like a Brian Ortega where it's like, okay, every second on the mat, you're in danger of being submitted. But she's good at tying up your hand. She's good at wasting minutes on the ground. And what I really like about Calvillo's game is that if she is able to get the takedown, it's really draining for her opponents. Like, you can tell it saps their cardio quick, because the thing with Calvillo is she will go from full guard to half guard, try to break down your legs. She won't allow you to just go full guard and try to do that lockdown, because in that lockdown position, the bottom fighter is not wasting a lot of energy. But if the top fighter is moving around a lot, forcing them to use their guard in dynamic ways, that's going to really, really sap the fighter on bottom. So I do like Calvillo. It just really, it's based on her overall ability to grapple.
In Andrea Lee's fights in the UFC, she has a fight of the night against Veronica Macedo. Macedo took her down. She fought Ashley Evans-Smith and beat her. Smith took her down twice. She fought Montana De La Rosa. She won that fight. De La Rosa took her down five times. She lost to Joanne Calderwood, who took her down twice. She lost to Lauren Murphy, who took her down twice. She lost to Roxanne Modafferi, who took her down four times. The only fight in the UFC that Andrea Lee's ever fought in where she didn't get taken down was against Antonina Shevchenko, where she took Shevchenko down and submitted her. Calvillo will most likely take her down. It's a tough fight for me, honest to goodness. It really is. I know the fan vote, 70% Calvillo, 30% Lee. The odds are relatively close. I like Calvillo ever so slightly, but again, I've thrown out your red flags. She got finished, however you want to take it. She got finished not that long ago. So how's she going to be able to come back from that? And Andrea Lee's a fighter that's like a Swiss Army knife. She is quite good at a lot of different things. It's just, can she get back, or can she get up off her back in some of those positions? And will she have the opportunity to tee off on volume in her fight against Calvillo, which Chookagian was able to do it. We've seen that happen in the past. So I'm really interested to see that. I ever so slightly have Calvillo in this fight, though.
Last thing on this fight, I just want to ask you, I believe at women's bantamweight, it's Amanda Nunes, Tremaine Randamie, and then everybody else. In this division, I think it's Valentina Shevchenko, Jessica Andrade, and then everybody else. Do you believe that too? Or do you think there are some contenders starting to get up into that pool?
It's like when I was walking around in, what's it called? What's the ritzy area of Toronto? Really ritzy area. People from Toronto are going to be yelling at me, and the rest of Canada is going to go, stop talking about Toronto. I'm from the East Coast. It's not like I go to Toronto all the time, but I'm walking around and there's this SUV that pulls up and the window goes down, and I turn to my now wife and I go, hey, that's French Montana. She goes, who, what? I went, no, I'm dead serious. I like, that's French Montana. So we pull him up on our phone. And as soon as I get a picture like of him up on my phone, everybody's flocking to that SUV and they're going, wow, that's French Montana. Holy crap, that's French Montana. That's just like Valentina Shevchenko in this division. Everybody's all over Shevchenko. Forget about everybody else. But Matt, like the French Montana song, nothing can stop me. I'm all the way up. I think Miranda Maverick's going to be one of those top five fighters that we have to watch out for coming all the way up, even though she lost to Macy Barber. But Matt, that's enough of the anecdotes. I think, Calvillo's got this one. We're both in agreement here. Both of us going with Cynthia Calvillo. What you're not going to want to miss is all the way up in the main event, Max Holloway taking on Yair Rodriguez. You're going to want to keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up at lightweight. We have a star on the rise and a star that is falling, Matt. Spain's Joel Alvarez, El Fenomeno, gets a chance to take that number next to Thiago Moises' name when they face off this weekend. I'm really excited about this one because you pit a couple of styles that are similar together, and we see what we're going to get from Moises. He lost in his first UFC main event, take on Islam Makhachev. However, he lasted a hell of a lot longer than Dan Hooker did in Makhachev's last fight. So, Matt, I look at it for Moises in the 5-1 in. He has a loss just over 2 years ago to Demiriz Magulov. That's going to happen. This guy's a dark horse. This guy's a guy who, if he made weight, who knows? Who knows? But that was just a couple of weeks ago. Matt, when I look at this fight for Thiago Moises, and you talk about fights aging like milk or aging like fine wine, I mean, man, his wins over Bobby Green and his last win that he had, again, to set him up for that main event over Alexander Hernandez. You want to talk about an action hero superstar? Those wins that he had right there, like 2011's Nicolas Cage flick, Drive Angry. When Thiago Moises fights angry, this guy scares me when I'm watching at home on my couch.
I agree with everything you said, but since I'm me, I'm going to make you really, really upset right now. I thought Bobby Green beat him. There you go. I thought Bobby Green beat Thiago Moises at the time. He puts a lot of volume on Moises, and that's really the only thing, a negative I can say about Thiago throughout his UFC tenure, is that he can get behind in a primary striking contest. Now, we see this a lot with primary grapplers. You can't be great at everything in MMA. Not everybody's GSP, or as Dana White now thinks, Kamaru Usman, the best
ever.
Well,
not just, whoa, we got to start letting him in. He gets a seat at the table.
What?
Kamaru gets a seat at the table.
Let me do my point, Craig. This is the thing about Moises. He's got a great game, but he does struggle in one really big area, which is the volume striking. And I know that's a weird thing to have concerns about, because normally we talk about guys and it's their inability to defend like power shots. That's something you have to be concerned about, because one power punch can put a guy's lights out. With Moises, he just gets behind so much with the volume and with some of the numbers that it does make me worry about him reaching for takedowns against the upper echelon guys. Now, I worry about these things when he fights guys like Justin Gaethje, when he fights guys like Islam Makhachev, of course, like we just saw, when he fights those type of names in this division. Those are the guys I think Moises should be fighting. And this is the last thing I'll say. I thought Bobby Green beat him, but this is my whole point. I don't know if Moises is a ranked lightweight. Like, if it was up to me, I could probably come up with 15 lightweights who I like a little bit more than him. But he's a bubble lightweight right now. And the fact that Moises is an arguable top 15 lightweight in the world means a lot. Because I know people go on about the bantamweight division, the featherweight division. To me, the lightweight division is still the best division in the UFC. And if you can prove that you're one of the top 15 guys at that weight class, then there must be something special about you. And the last point I'll make before I hand it off to you is, if it wasn't a main event, he would have just lost a decision to Islam. I know that's like you're really starting to bend the rules in your own way. And I get it. I'm only saying it as a joke. But still, if you just look at the success and the run that Islam has been on, Drew Dober got mollywopped and submitted like it was nothing. Same thing with Dan Hooker. So the fact that Moises was at least able to make some of those grappling exchanges a little bit competitive does give me a lot of confidence when he's fighting another primary grappler in Alvarez.
Matt, so let's talk about this fight, because for Joel Alvarez, listen, 100% hand to goodness gracious, if we want to get crazy, one of the most confident underdog picks I've ever had on this channel was when Alvarez took on Joe Duffy. And I'm dead serious. Joe was he at TriStar? Was he not at TriStar? He had a long time layoff. He wasn't on the right track. He's not the same guy that fought Conor McGregor on the regional scene. He's not even the guy that came into the UFC. And when we went into that fight, it was like, yeah, Alvarez is going to win this fight. He's going to submit him. This is easy. And Alvarez was, what, a plus 245 in that fight? Book it. Sure. 100% he's going to win that fight. Okay, even before that, Danilo Belluardo, he wasn't meant to be in the UFC. What? Alvarez is going to win that fight 100%. When you're fighting Alexander Yakovlev, a guy who strikes to wrestle to...
No. We just need to call him out. A guy who got dropped by Damian Maia on the feet. That's the type of fighter he is. Gets dropped with the first straight Damian Maia lands on him.
Yakovlev, you know, not ready for primetime player like on SNL. And for Alvarez, he gets him caught in this very, very slick submission. And if you want to get caught in a trap, you go into UFC, you go into fightmetric.rds.ca, you go into upcoming, then you find this fight, and you look at the numbers. Significant strikes, they favor Alvarez. You look at the numbers in terms of sub attempts per 15 minutes, they favor Alvarez. And in a vacuum, that all looks great. On the back of a UFC Chronicles card, 15-minute card breaks, their second channel, check it out. On the back of a card like that.
More, though, that you're just not successfully finishing them.
For Alvarez, they look really good. And no, by the way, out of those fights, Matt, he has 3 finish wins. So no, he is very, very successful against those guys. Great 3-fight win streak. I see this as too much too soon. Joe Duffy was nowhere even close. Like, he was smoking cigars, like golf references. He was having a case of beer with the boys, sitting at the table smoking cigars when he fought Alvarez. Like, we're not even close to the prime guy. So Matt, when I look at this fight, Thiago Moises for the odds in this one is a pretty big favorite. Open to minus 130. That's a surprise. Minus 243 right now. Alvarez open to plus 110. He's plus 194. I haven't looked at the Tapology votes, Matt. I'm going to guess 85% Moises over under.
Yeah, probably over.
890 total votes, 70% Moises, 74% by decision for the 30% that have Alvarez, 49% by decision, 33% by submission. I mean, honest to goodness, I'm dead serious. Alvarez is a very interesting fighter. His UFC debut, Demiris Magulov, who then would go on to fight Thiago Moises and beat him too. So that's kind of fun. Former common opponent. Thiago Moises is a lot better of a fighter than Joel Alvarez and way better on the feet. And I know Alvarez continues to make gains in his stand-up. You go to his Instagram, he's wearing the knee pads. He's wearing the boxing gloves, whatever. He does have a good ground game. His ground game is nowhere near Thiago Moises's. Okay. And Matt, put me on a poster.
This you got like an inch and you took a mile, Craig. You got to slow down a little.
Hold on. This is like you saying, Jacare's never going to get submitted by Andrea Muniz. That's never going to happen. I don't see Thiago Moises getting beat by Joel Alvarez, and I'll just leave it there.
Your confidence is making me want to pick Joel Alvarez, and that's just me being 100% honest right now. This is the thing. Thiago Moises should be able to win this fight. He's the much better fighter in the majority of areas. I don't agree with the point on his striking, though, and I do worry about him striking his upper-level guys in the UFC. And this would be the really important fight for that, because if we do see him struggle, at least in open range with Joel Alvarez, he's going to have a lot of trouble against anybody in the top 15 he does come across. Like, if we see Alvarez able to really establish his jab, make Moises shoot from really far away, defend those labor takedowns, and just lead him later on into the fight, I think there is an area for Alvarez to leave with a dub. I really do. Now, the flip side is Moises has shown the ability to end fights immediately when they're on the mat. This is the thing. You disagreed with what I was trying to say, but you didn't let me finish. Submission attempts is just like shot attempts per game in basketball. Like, just because you're going for a lot doesn't mean the success rate on them is always very high. That's my point with Alvarez. He just goes for a lot of them. And yes, sometimes he's able to lock one up because it is that submission through obscurity. If I go for a lot of stuff, eventually one is going to catch. That stuff doesn't work against a guy like Moises, who just is so traditionally sound. We saw Moises get caught in a submission his last time out, but that was due to fatigue and due to the fact that he was fighting probably the most dominant wrestler in the division now that Khabib is gone. I don't think Alvarez has any of those skill sets, so I like Moises quite a bit.
Both of us going with Thiago Moises in this fight, but I really want to hear from the fans out there, because I know there's been a lot of people riding that wave of the Spanish fighters like Chris Barnett. How crazy is that? Representing Spain. No, but really for Alvarez, he is a very talented fighter. I just think, you know, like Corey Anderson once said, there's levels to this. So both
and then he
got
knocked unconscious his next fight. So it's not great to say there's levels.
Both of us going with Brazil's Thiago Moises in this fight. If you think we're silly, you let us know down below. I'll tell you what's not silly, Matt. The matchmaking in our main event, Yair Rodriguez taking on Max Holloway. You want dynamic strikers, you got them. Just keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Ho, 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 gentlemen. The holidays came early here at Manscaped, the leading men's hygiene brand. Manscaped just launched new products, including what Matt Allen has in front of him in his well-lit room. Matt, open that box up.
Let's see
what's in there.
It's exciting.
I'm talking, the holidays are actually coming early, and I haven't seen what's in that box.
Ooh.
Matt doesn't even know what's inside that box. It's actually a surprise to him. That's the best part about this.
I have no idea. There's two of them. Ooh. I am excited because it's something that your boy can definitely use. We've got shampoo and conditioner from Manscaped. That's a nice bottle, too. I'll let you continue.
What's in the second one? Come on. It's going to be their all-new Ultra Premium Body Wash. I hate to spoil it for you. But that's exactly what it is. Listen, guys out there, it's time to give yourself or someone who needs it the gift of beautiful skin, hair, and balls this holiday season. So go to manscaped.com, use the promo code FNP, and you're going to get 20% off and free shipping. Listen, jingle balls to the walls, fella. You want to listen up. Untrimmed pubes are a thing of the past, and it's possible that you have Santa's beard in your pants. So if you know what we've talked about for a while, you got to pick up the Performance Package 4.0. Now, Matt, I tell the story every week. I'm the type of guy, I'm bringing my Performance Package 4.0 with me on the road. And look at me. I'm on the road, and my Performance Package 4.0 is upstairs. Now, we get to see the beautiful floral print of your apartment downstairs inside baseball. But the thing that I don't have with me is, of course, the new products from Manscaped. And there's definitely a lot to love over on their site. They just launched, like I said, the 2-in-1 shampoo and conditioner, which has key ingredients with benefits that include hydrating, nourishing, conditioning the scalp, and strengthening your hair at the same time. You're going to get those great products that you know and love from Manscaped. So listen, 'tis the season to load up on Manscaped products. So get yourself, your dad, your brother, and friends the best gift of all, the Manscaped Performance Package 4.0. You know that the hygiene bundle that they have, it's going to come with a pair of Manscaped anti-chafing boxers that'll keep your junk feeling fresh all day. The perfect package for your perfect package. And I mean, listen, inside of that, just a performance package on its own, what it's going to come with, the Lawnmower 4.0. I've talked about it here and there, the Crop Preserver and the Crop Reviver. You get the ball toner, you get the ball deodorant. And if you want to add a little bit of spice to your order, make sure you check out those new products. I went on the website, again, manscaped.com today before I came on to talk about this, because again, I haven't had the products in my hands yet. I haven't had the chance to try them in the shower. So I'll report back a week from now. But what I can tell you is, yeah, you can add that on when you're picking up that performance package 4.0. Matt, I know you're excited to try the products, but you can't try mine. Those ones are mine.
No, what? I'm excited. Yeah. As the person, like, you might be the nose hair expert, but I'm the head hair expert. So I'll get back to people on how good this shampoo and conditioner really is. Cause I don't know if yours can even move at this point, Craig. So I'll give the reviews for this stuff.
It's frozen in time. Matt, get 20% off and free shipping with code FNP at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com. Use promo code FNP. Clean up your nuts and make old Saint Nick proud this year. Straight up, my favorite fight coming up this weekend. We have China Sung Yadong taking on the man himself, Julio Arce, a guy who's redefined himself at 135 pounds. And count me as one of the doubters. I didn't think he was going to be able to make weight successfully. I didn't know how the cardio was going to be able to fare. And he went out there and put on an absolute performance his last time out. And we know exactly what we're going to get out of Sung Yadong. He's the guy that, does he wrestle? He can, but he's primarily a boxer. And for Julio Arce, does he fight like his teammate Shane Burgos? 9 times out of 10. Yeah, he does. He targets the body, throws nice leg kicks. He can do it up in the clinch. He has cardio for days. But again, I bring it all back to the fact that can he string it together for 3 rounds? And again, his last time out, he didn't need to. He ended up finishing a very durable Andre Ewell in that second round. So Matt, I'll throw it on over to you. I cannot contain my excitement in the away game for Craig Allen in these confines. Matt, I'm excited about the fight. What are you saying?
This fight should be higher up on the card. It really should. Like, this is my co-main event. Hashtag my co-main event. That's what Sung Yadong Julio Arce is. Because these are not only ranked fighters, these are just two really well-rounded fighters. And no matter where this fight ends up, it's going to be really entertaining because we know Song can go for his own offensive takedowns. We know how good his overall just MMA game is, really. And the same thing can be said for Julio Arce. But of course, this fight is probably going to be contested on the feet. So that's what I'm going to focus on right now. I think Julio Arce has improved his striking like few other fighters have in the UFC, if I'm being completely honest. Like, I really do think Julio Arce has made massive improvements between his first UFC fight and now, and it has been a lot due to his striking. It's not just that he seems a little bit faster, he seems a little bit more powerful. He's just kind of cleaned up his technique across the board. It's just, there's less movement in everything he does, so it allows him to get from point A to point B a lot faster, and that's something that's really hard to improve on. It's like, again, you know football better than me, so if I'm speaking out of terms, please let me know. But like, Josh Allen improved his accuracy, and that's something they say quarterbacks have a really hard time doing. But he was able to improve his accuracy.
And then he lost to the Jaguars and didn't even get close to covering the point spread.
Sure.
You asked, you got the answer.
This is the thing about Julio Arce, though. I just asked if that was a good comparison, though, but it seemed like it was. With Arce, he has been able to make up those improvements, but the big thing that I see in this fight being an issue for him is he's not going to be able to out-jab Sung Yadong at range, and I don't know how he's going to get on the inside of Sung Yadong's punching power and his punching ability, because with Song, you can't stand on the outside. He is one of the most dangerous boxers in this division, and he's really, really accurate. There's not a lot of wasted shots from him. His stand-up is kind of Pyotr Yan-ish. I know people are going to say that's blasphemy because he's like the best boxer in the UFC probably, but just offensively, there are some similarities. Like, Song can be really patient. He can really let himself go when he decides to be aggressive. The difference, though, is Song can't do defensively what Pyotr Yan can do in the cage. I guess I'll give it to you. How do you see Julio Arce winning moments at range? Of course, he's the better kicker in this fight, but do you think he can just put up the sheer numbers he's going to need to against a guy like Song who is so precise?
It's going to have to be a lot of feints, and it's one of those things. I kind of joked about it in the last couple of weeks. Who was it? Dustin Jacoby, when he's fighting last weekend. He's throwing that hand out there. It's the simple little misdirections. Kamaru Usman faking the takedown. Phil Haas faking the takedown until things just hit the fan. But I like the misdirection. I like the feints for a guy like that training under Tiger Schulman, having the Riveras and the Burgoses, you know, BKFC's own Jimmy Rivera, you know him, right? But having guys like that to train with to get ready for a fight like this, it's perfect. For Song Yadong, having a guy like Cody Garbrandt, perfect to get ready for a fight like this. That's Song's last Instagram post. But a Team Alpha Male, we know the cast and characters, the Chad Mendez's, BKFC's own, Darren Elkin, so on and so forth. So many good guys out there. Matt, I just want to throw this one out there quick before we focus odds, before we break down the tail end of the fight. For Song Yadong, 2 years, almost 2 years and a half, he fought Turbo Alejandro Perez. It's crazy to think that he's a couple weeks shy of his 24th birthday and he had that fight. And for Arce, it's just been a slow burn. He came into the UFC in 2018. He had a fun fight against Dan Ige. I was there for their debuts. That was a lot of fun. But then since then, he beats Daniel Taymor by submission. He loses to Shaymon Marais by split decision. He finishes Julian Arosa. He loses a split decision to Hakeem Dawodu. And he beats Andre Yule down a weight class at 135. This seems like the future home. This is like that heel turn for Jose Aldo too. We're moving down to 135 where all the big boys play, like the small guys play. I don't know what to say. But the craziest thing for him is he just turned 32 himself. So it's crazy to see the age gap between these two guys, but the skills that they both possess at the same time. So I'm going to bring up the odds for this one. I'll have a look at best fight odds for Arce. He is the underdog. He opened a plus 105. He's plus 117. Yadong opened a minus 125. Went down as far as a minus 155. He's a minus 142 right now. Tapology votes in this one, 883 of them. 84% Song Yadong, 79% by decision. For the 16% that of Arce, 63% by decision. Matt, I'm going to hand it off to you on this one. For Song Yadong to be a slight favorite in this fight, I'm surprised to see so many people on Tapology picking him to win. That doesn't normally correlate.
I'm going to flip it around. I'm surprised the odds are so close in this fight, to be completely honest. Wow. I get Julio Arce is that fight of the night kind of a guy. He could put on a really good performance against pretty much anybody. But Julio Arce needs a fight to be ugly for him to really succeed. And even in those ugly fights, like I always go back to the Shaymon Marais fight. He's dropped hard by Shaymon in that a couple of times. And I don't think Shaymon's anywhere near the striker Song Yadong is, especially not at this moment for Song Yadong. So I'm going to pick Yadong in this matchup. I think he's the much cleaner striker on the feet. And this is the thing about Song Yadong. He makes his power shots count. He's not somebody like Jan Blachowicz is who we brought up when he lost to Glover. Like, he was throwing big uppercuts on his back foot. And when you throw techniques like that, they leave you open to be countered. Song doesn't get countered very much on the feet. He's the one doing the countering, even if he's leading the dance. So I think for as long as this is on the feet, and I do expect it to primarily be contested there, I like Song Yadong in this matchup.
It is a tricky fight. I mean, for Yadong, he's got a performance of the night bonus over Barat Kandari, who, listen, there's always rumors because that guy's still in the USADA testing pool that he might make a comeback. Performance win over Felipe Arantes. He's got a performance win over Turbo. He's got a fight of the night against Marlon Vera that he won.
Who fights a lot like Julio Arce.
That one ages like wine. And then you focus on it. I mean, what could we take away for negatives? Kyler Phillips was able to hold him down. Cody Stamann was able to hold him down. Again, that was a really close fight. Say what
then
you will about
it. Then he beat the brakes off Casey Kenney, though. Who's a pretty good wrestler.
He didn't beat that. That was a split decision win.
It wasn't really split, though. I thought he won two of the three quite soundly. But it just, if you're concerned about Song Yadong's wrestling, that shows that he can defend takedowns from a high-level wrestler. If you're concerned about his volume striking, look at the Marlon Vera fight. That shows that he can volume strike with another primary striker. I'm just saying, he has some performances in the UFC that really do set him up for this kind of a matchup.
I have Song Yadong in this fight. A little bit surprised by those Tapology votes. But again, I want to hear from everybody down below in the comment section on this one, because Julio Arce is a very, very good striker. I've been high on him since he's come into the UFC. Maybe there's a little bit of that shine for being there as a fan live for that first card before becoming a media member. But Matt, yeah, both of us going with the man training at Team Alpha Male. Let us know down below who you have, not just in this fight, but in the rest of them. And Matt, up at the top of the card, big time fight feels. Max Holloway taking on Yair Rodriguez. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Absolute banger at middleweight. This weekend, we have Georgia's Roman Dolidze taking on A guy who, man, his ceiling could not be higher at this point. It is, of course, Chris's brother, Kyle Daukaus. He's really broken out of that shell. And no matter what you make of his last fight, which was a no contest against Kevin Holland, he was having a ton of success before the clash of heads. And then after the clash of heads, he had even more success where he was able to finish the fight. But after the fact, you know, we have that replay review where members of the UFC were in the ear of the commission. That was a really awkward moment.
It was a no contest, Craig. I don't like what you're doing right
now. It was a no contest. I just don't like it when Mark Ratner and Sean Shelby are able to kind of enter into the conversation.
Craig, there were refs around there too, and that's their job to monitor the film and to give that information to the ref inside the cage. They did nothing wrong.
It was awkward. Now we get a fight that's not as awkward as their banter right there, because for Roman, he was getting ready for a fight against your boy, Eric Anders. Anders out of the fight. And it was supposed to be the rematch of that fight between Kevin Holland and Kyle Daukaus for this weekend. So both guys, they just crisscross, everybody clap your hands. We get this fight. Come on. Yeah. So Matt, when I look at this one, I can talk about the accolades, and I have in video after video after video for our fighter out of Georgia here. He's a former Filo World Grappling champion, ADCC guy. He's medaled in certain competitions. But when you watch Roman Dolidze fight, the trouble I have and the biggest takeaway that I have is he almost gets too busy trying to impress everybody at home and his coaches and not as focused on finishing the fight at hand. That got him in trouble against Trevin Giles, where it started to go a little bit more downhill as that fight went on. And we make jokes. It's a Fight Night Picks exclusive. Matt kind of rolls his eyes. That Trevin Giles power jab was on point that night. And then in his last fight for Roman, he fights Laureano Staropoli, where, yeah, he does have a lot of success. It's just, I wish he would finish more fights. And for Kyle Daukaus, we bring it back. He loses his UFC debut on short notice against Brendan Allen, but there were a lot of positives to take out of it. He finished strong in that fight. It was a good one. Then he comes out, he beats Dustin Stoisfus, a guy that might be a little small, maybe for 185, but a very well-rounded guy on paper, 100%. He wins that fight and looks good. Then he loses to Phil Hawes. Okay. All right. And then he was on his way to beating Kevin Holland.
No,
even
he
before
wasn't.
The...
Stop it. Nothing happened up until then. Craig, even if you look at the stats, Kyle Daukaus had 9 strikes. Kevin Holland had 3 up until the head clash. He at least landed 1 strike after the head clash. So you cannot stand here and tell me that Kyle Daukaus was dominating Kevin Holland when he was ahead by like 2
clinched
significant
him up
strikes
against the cage,
headbutt.
Was working the takedowns.
No. If you put any stock into that, I can't put any stock into the Kevin Holland matchup. I really can't. A, because
this is
Kevin
this
Holland
is,
Roman Dolidze.
This is the point. This is the point that I'll make before I hand it off to you. The only positive that I have out of the Holland fight, well, actually, there's two. One, spotlight wasn't too big against 2020's Fighter of the Year, whose star has definitely diminished. It definitely has, but the spotlight wasn't too big in a giant fight. Two, in that fight, he didn't look all that bad, and he was able to accentuate the things that he's good at. Where I want to hand this off to you, Matt, is the fact that Kyle Daukaus is a decent striker, but excels at grappling. He's going to take on one of the scariest grapplers at 185 pounds coming up this weekend. So I really do want to get your thoughts on just this matchup alone. Dolidze, who is scheduled to take on a guy that's pretty good at striking, but also wrestling, and Eric Anders, some comparables there, versus Kyle Daukaus, who is getting ready for a primary striker if there ever was one.
This thing about Roman, he's the better grappler when his gas tank is near full. Like, cars don't work like this in real life, where the less gas you have, the slower you move. But that kind of is the case with Roman.
There's only one episode of Seinfeld where Kramer tries to take the Saab as far as he can. But even then, the Saabs turn out like Roman. And in the third round, you get scared.
But this, like, Roman can have success grappling against Kyle Daukaus for like 3 minutes in this fight. And then I really do think the field gets even. Like, if you could have success grappling against Brendan Allen, I think you can have success grappling against Roman Dolidze. I don't not believe that for a second. Like, Allen's a much more consistent fighter than Dolidze. He's a much more polished fighter than Dolidze. And they do a lot of the same stuff. And I really do think that if you can face adversity against a really big, strong grappler like Brendan Allen early in their fight, and then turn around to borderline get a 10-8 round against him in the third, does that not exactly sound like how a fight against Roman Dolidze would go with Kyle Daukaus? He might lose the first 2 rounds, but come on really strong in the third. This is what I like about Daukaus. If he knows he's behind in a fight, he goes for it. He doesn't just like kind of rest back and think, okay, if I win this round, maybe it'll tie it up. Like, there is an urgency to his game that I really do appreciate. That's where this fight gets really interesting, because more than any other fight on this card, this comes down to cardio. If Roman does go for takedowns, I guess, okay, I'll flip this around. It comes down to cardio, but it comes down to how well can Kyle Daukaus defend the takedown attempts of Roman. Because on the feet, Daukaus's jab should actually be able to give Dolidze some trouble on the outside, because with Dolidze, it's a lot of those looping wild shots where you aim big, you miss big. And if Daukaus can stay pretty technical and accurate on the outside, I think he can have good success, although I do worry about him against really polished strikers in this division. But on the mat, I think Daukaus is honestly the better grappler. I do. I think stylistically, this is kind of a tough matchup for Dolidze. Because hear me out. With Roman, he is great when he's really explosive. But everything he does is extremely unique. He goes for leg locks. He doesn't go for traditional submissions and transitions. I think when you're doing all that like unique, weird stuff, that's great. But the second you get tired, that's when we see just a really consistent fighter start to overtake you. And that's why I could see that's when we could see Kyle Daukaus. I think we could see him out grapple Dolidze for big moments in this fight.
Well, this is the funny thing. So as we're talking about this one, I figured, okay, I'm going to look up Dolidze's fights in the UFC. So he fought Hadis Ibrahimov, no longer in the UFC. He fought John Allen, who lost to a short notice opponent, Dustin Jacoby, on the weekend. Beats John Allen. I just want to get that out of the way. Loses to Trevin Giles, who on his best day is a top 15 middleweight. And I'm not joking about that. We got to start giving Trevin his flowers, Houston's finest. And then he beats Laureano Steropoli, a blown up welterweight who just got cut from the UFC after losing to the Nightwolf, Jamie Pickett. So, Matt, the wins, I mean, he beat John Allen by split. Again, he had a lot of success.
We could say the same thing about Daukaus, though. Now, if we're being honest.
Hear me out. This is where I'm going with my point. Against Hadis Ibrahimov, Roman's the favorite. Against John Allen, he's the favorite. Against Trevin Giles, he's the favorite. Against Laureano Steropoli, he's the favorite. Matt, I'm going to try and find you some sites that have odds on this one. Dolidze opened this fight a plus 120 underdog. He's a plus 180 underdog. For Kyle Daukaus, he is a decent-sized favorite. Open to minus 140, minus 223 right now. We've never seen Roman Dolidze as an underdog in the UFC, and that's quite a bit of a surprise. Like, again, it's not surprising until it is. It's surprising when it happens. That's why I am surprised.
It's because it's not scary anymore. Like with Roman Dolidze, you know what's under the bed. It's a guy who's really good but gets tired. Like there's no more monsters. We kind of know the information we need to know about Dolidze.
That's kind of what my wife ends up with, like late at night. You know, she tries wrestling under the covers. It's a guy that's, you know, late at night. He's under there. He gets tired. So you better get the work out of the way quick.
Not where I thought this was going. Here, this is the thing. With Daukaus, he's just a more consistent guy. And the thing is, if I've seen you lose because you get tired in the past, I'm pretty sure it's going to continue to happen to you in the future. And even in the John Allen fight, we brought that up on the prediction show last week, where that fight was pretty close, like closer than either one of us would probably want to admit. And it was only close, not because technically the fighters were very similar. It's just because Roman gets so tired. I don't know if it's the weight cut. I don't know if it's just because he is so muscle bound for this division. Like there has to be some sort of a factor. He puts a lot behind his shots. It's always like all gas, no brakes with Dolidze. That's my real problem. And this is why I think Daukaus can outgrapple him. We've even seen Rodolfo Vieira get outgrappled in the UFC. I know that's a bit of a soft spot on this channel, but it's the truth. Fatigue makes a coward out of men. I don't know who said that quote, but I know it's a famous one. There you go. I think that's going to be the case with Roman. I think he will look good in the first round, but like we've seen before, if Kyle Daukaus can get over that speed bump, get over that hurdle, I think he'll be able to take over as the fight progresses.
835 total Tapology votes, 64% with Daukaus, 69% by decision for the 36% that have Dolidze, 65% by decision, 23% by knockout. I have a hard path to victory seeing Dolidze winning this fight by decision. That's the biggest trouble. I mean, I could see him winning by leg lock in the first round. I could see him winning by, like, heck, even a knockout in the first round. That's a trouble. The Roman that we saw outside of the UFC struck like Roque Martinez. Like, you're throwing spinning attacks, spinning elbows. You're throwing, like, your hands from the hips, like Alexander Romanov at heavyweight as well. I know he fought Roque, but both of those guys, like a Chris Barnett type striker. I'm just going with heavyweight wild men, but that's my point. Really wild, really from the hip, with a ton of power, with a lot of energy expended, knowing that you're most likely going to end the fight in the first round or the second round. So for Dolidze, that's it. The gas tank is such a big factor. It's such a hindrance to me, and the volume as well. So for those reasons, I like Daukaus. Maybe you want to sprinkle a little bit on a Dalidze finish by submission. Maybe you like him in the first round. It's just, to me, he's been a little bit too much of a people pleaser and a little bit less like the fighter that we saw coming into the UFC, getting a little bit crazy, training out of Ukraine. I don't know what they've done at Extreme Couture, but maybe he can find his footing coming up this weekend, not fighting Anders and now taking on Daukaus. But for me, I've got Daukaus here.
No, I agree 100%.
Both of us going with Chris's brother, Kyle, to get the win. We're going with Pennsylvania's own Kyle Daukaus here. Matt, big time fights coming up. Listen, Leah Letson, the return, taking on former title challenger Felicia Spencer, unranked heavyweights in the co-main event between Rothwell and Rogério de Lima. And then, Matt, in our main event, ooh boy, Max Holloway taking on Yair Rodriguez. You're not going to want to miss it, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
And a long-awaited return to the UFC's octagon for Trust the Nightest Touch. It's Leah Letson, and we haven't seen her since almost 3 years ago when she picked up a split decision win over Lithuania's Yulia Stoyarenko, and a lot of different health issues being the barrier to a re-entry for Letson. So finally, she gets paired up, a big-time fight where she competed on The Ultimate Fighter at featherweight against a former title challenger in the Phenom, Felicia Spencer. Matt, the record not that sexy in the last five for Spencer, because if you look at it, she gets a win over Megan Anderson in her UFC debut. Awesome. She was an underdog. She was overlooked. Huge pop. She fights Chris Cyborg. Doesn't get finished. Then she goes out there and she takes on Zara Farron, and predictably, she finishes her. I mean, listen, I wasn't surprised. Then she takes on Amanda Nunes, and listen, doesn't get finished. And then her last time out there, she takes on the immortal Norma Dumont. Hey, the hotness at 145 right now, winning main events at 145 right now is Norma Dumont. And in that fight, she loses. But listen, it's by split decision. She doesn't get finished in that one. So Matt, for me, again, 2 wins to 3 losses in the 5-on-in for Felicia Spencer. A lot of activity, I guess we could say, in comparison to Leah Letson. But Matt, a lot of fans might not be familiar with Leah Letson, and I know that, oddly enough, UFC or The Ultimate Fighter, Heavy Hitters, that was a season that you followed quite closely. What can you tell me about Leah Letson other than the fact that, per her Instagram, she's an approved instructor for concealed carry in the States?
She's a really good forward aggression type of a striker. She does bring a lot to the cage. My whole problem, though, and just with this fight and with a lot about this fight, I need to know what's going on with the division past like 2 days. Like, it would be really nice to have some sort of clarity on what's going to happen to the women's featherweight division. And are they going to keep it around? Because to me, it almost seems unjust to force Felicia Spencer to continue to fight in a division that she can't progress anywhere in. Like, you work for a really big company, and I'm sure that if you keep on doing a really, really good job, you can keep on like going up in the company. Cause that's how
I can own Fight Night Picks.
Fair. With Felicia Spencer, she's kind of stagnant no matter what happens. Like, she could win 10 fights in a row at this division. I guess the UFC would just have to keep on re-signing new talent for her to fight. But you get the idea. For me, she's behind Norma Dumont now, which is weird because I never thought she would lose that fight. But I did think at the time that Dumont deserved that decision win. And we know she's not as good as Chris Cyborg, arguably one of the greatest women's athletes of all time. And same thing with Amanda Nunes. So when you're judging where Felicia Spencer really sits in the division, she's still kind of the number one contender, which makes this fight really, really odd. And this is a huge opportunity for Leah Letson in her first fight back. I really do think that has to be said, because if she is able to get a win over Felicia Spencer, I know maybe the hype around Spencer, if there ever was some, isn't as high as it was when she was getting title shots, but I still think a win over Felicia Spencer means something. It means that at least you belong in this division, or at least the UFC has a place for you moving forward. So I guess to circle back to your original question, I actually think Leah Letson can have a lot of success on the feet against Felicia Spencer, but it's really weird. We've seen Spencer look good in moments on the feet in some fights, but we've also seen her look really bad in moments on the feet in some fights, and that's what's so odd. Like, if you go back to the Chris Cyborg performance, I know she lost that fight quite handily, but she has a few techniques that actually do a really good job landing. She throws that weird, like, superwoman elbow that cuts Cyborg on the forehead, and she throws that technique quite a few times, and it is able to land. But I don't know if I should put a lot of stock into that and think, okay, is Felicia Spencer one of these strikers who can adapt as she's fighting and kind of find the holes as she's in there? Or is that just something that she would have drilled a lot and it just kept on working in the fight? I know they seem like the same thing, but one is something you bring into the fight and you continue to do. One is something that you learn on the job while doing. I don't know if Spencer can make a lot of in-game adjustments with her striking. And I do think Letson can at least make some adjustments during the fight to at least stifle some of the attack of Spencer.
And the other thing about Letson, she also has quite good wrestling. She also can threaten with submissions as well. That's the really good thing. Like, if you haven't gone out and watched a Leah Letson performance, please do. I mean, maybe you don't want to see the Stoyarenko split decision. You might not take a lot from it. Maybe you won't take a lot from the Macy Chasson win, but wins over Bia Malecki on The Ultimate Fighter. Elizabeth Phillips, where she finishes her in that fight. Sarah Payant. Now, this is the real big thing, Matt. Out of the wins, I'm going to read you, you know, we got to talk in terms of zeros and ones here. Cheyenne Cox, debuting fighter, after losing a split decision to kick off Leah Letson's career, beats Elena Jones, 2-6. Sarah Payant, 1-2. Elizabeth Phillips, 5-4. Beats Malecki, who would have been what, like 1-0 going into that season. Loses to Macy Chasson, beats 4-2-1 Yulia Stoyarenko. And I can talk somebody's ear off about Yulia Stoyarenko and her time fighting in Lethway, like all the crazy things she's done in her career. And then they matched her up with fighters in 2019, Sarah Morris and Duda Santana. That's the thing that scares me. It's been a long time off. I read Leah's post over on her Instagram. She says, nearly 8 weeks out from my fight. This is when it was posted. It's honestly a miracle I'm even healthy enough to take a fight again. There were so many dark days I've had to go through to get to this point for a long time. It wasn't even a guarantee that I would ever be able to fight again or undo the damage to my body and organs. It's incredible how far I've come and how much I've had to overcome just to get to this point. I'm so proud of myself for never giving up when everyone else in my position would have. I'm dead serious. This is like breaking all the walls here. That's awesome. Like,
it is.
To follow your dream, to be off for that long, to get a fight in the UFC, and hell, for Craig and Matt Allen, and I'm not like no selling this, to I think it's a halfway competitive fight too, even though, again, I think she would have had a better shot against Duda Santana or Sarah Morris. This is a tough fight, but she has different wrinkles to her game that make this one interesting.
They make it interesting, but I guess this will just be like my last little prediction bit.
Yeah.
This just feels like they're setting Spencer up for a win. It really does. Like, Spencer's one of the few 145ers who does have somewhat of a name still in this division because she's been around for a little while. Like, not a lot of fighters in this division can say that they actually have a five on in the UFC. And Felicia Spencer does. Like, her fifth to last fight was that Megan Anderson fight. So she has been around for a little while now. And it was a close fight against Dumont. I could see if she is able to get this win over Letson, maybe they roll that one back. I know that's weird to say. It's just main like, event. What else do you do with these athletes at a certain point? So I like Spencer for this reason. When we talk about just skills, there's nothing Letson does all that much better than Spencer. There's not one area of her game that you can really point to and say, she really jumps out and she can do this way better than Felicia Spencer. When I think about Spencer's at least offensive grappling capabilities on the mat, they really do stand out. I know she got controlled by Amanda Nunes, but there's levels, and quite frankly, nobody's on Nunes's level, but she has shown the ability to be a really tricky fighter. She can go past your guard. She really likes going to the back. And when Spencer is in that top position, she is a dangerous, dangerous submission threat.
I won't even bother with the odds. I mean, realistically, Felicia Spencer is quite the favorite in this one. The Tapology votes, 919 of them, 94% Spencer, 50% by decision, 37% by submission. I want to make sure I get that right, not over knockout. I think Spencer's going to win this fight. I think the wrestling is going to be the defense, the cardio, and the pressure. It's just, activity and no major injuries and, you know, like issues, barriers away from the cage. I think it's awesome that Leah Letson's back. And if she wins, I'm going to be the first one lined up to congratulate her on this channel. I can guarantee that. But for me, I've got to go with the transplanted Canadian training out of the States, and both of us going with Felicia Spencer. Matt, unranked heavyweights in the co-main event. Are you ready for it?
I am.
Are you ready? Ben Rothwell taking on Marcos Rogério de Lima. You're not going to want to miss it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Interesting co-main event, and you always scratch your head when they decide to pit two unranked heavyweights together, but that's exactly what we're going to get this weekend as Big Ben Rothwell takes on Big Marcos Rogério de Lima. And I say that because Matt, de Lima is not a heavyweight throughout his career. I mean, this is a guy that came into the UFC off of the Ultimate Fighter Brazil. It was season 3 at heavyweight. Now, he did lose to your eventual champion, Antonio Carlos Jr., your current PFL light heavyweight champion. Congrats. Hats off to him. But in his next fight, well, it's at heavyweight, but he weighs 235 pounds. And then he goes down and he fights Igor Prokhorchuk. Now, I butchered that, but 205 pounds on the nose. And that was a career trajectory for Mr. Rogério de Lima. And then you look at it, and there's a point where he fights Adam Vikšarek, and it's 253 pounds. But before that, it was OSP, 210 pounds. And you go, okay, what happened? Well, de Lima, potential USADA violation. That's what Tapology says when he's supposed to fight Saparbek Safarov. All of this to say, that's when Marcos decided he was going to make the move. So he weighs 253 against Vikšarek, 255 against Struve, 257 against Bensasoli, 258 against Romanov, 264.5 against Maurice Green. Matt, do you see a trend here? He's significantly weighed more in every single heavyweight fight he's had since he's come back to heavyweight recently. He's going to take on a guy in Ben Rothwell that traditionally cuts to make it to heavyweight, who was supposed to fight Felipe Lins, who was supposed to be on this card. Maybe he will. His fight against OSP is out. But my favorite thing ever is that quote that Stipe Miocic had when he was getting on a plane, getting ready to fight Francis Ngannou, and Ben Rothwell's there, getting ready to go early to Vegas. And Stipe's like, hey, Ben, who are you going to fight? And Ben goes, Felipe Lins. And they both, who's this? You know, the guy that won the $1 million with PFL. Who's this guy? What? Huh? Matt, I hand it off to you this way. Marcos Rogério de Lima is a finisher to the nth degree. He is an exciting striker. He is a guy that, like Ben Rothwell's recent opponent in Chris Barnett, can pull off some wild stuff. But at heavyweight, I kind of haven't really seen it all that much.
Pre-USADA, pre-heavyweight, just like... Marcos Rogério de Lima at 205 was like the perfect fighter. Now, he was far from it, but just humor me for a second. He had absurd knockout ability, really good Muay Thai technique, really, really fast hands for like the size of him, because he does have one of those like Fedor Emelianenko builds. He's kind of round. He's not the most lean guy in the world.
We should say about that whole USADA thing, that was the same JDS thing where there was a bad lab and it wasn't necessarily their fault. It really wasn't. So we should clear that one up before we go too much further, but there was a fair amount of a layoff for him there.
Exactly. And before that layoff, or at least leading into the OSP fight, I thought he was going to beat Ovin St. Preux. I actually thought he was going to knock him out, because I thought OSP was at least somewhat over the hill, and that was back in 2017. So that tells you how weird the career of Ovin St. Preux has been. But anyways, OSP gets the Von Flew over de Lima. De Lima misses weight. And then after that, no one really knows. Like, is he going to ever be the same fighter? But you know what I hate, Craig? It's when guys used to weigh 205 pounds and now they have to cut weight to make 265 pounds. Now, the list is very short. There's not a lot of fighters who have gone through this, but we're pretty lucky. We have a recent example that we can bring up. Jean Vellante, my favorite UFC fighter of all time. Again, this is a big thing in boxing. When guys start to balloon in weight later on in their career, it's normally because of something. Like, okay, this is why I kind of disagree when people say get rid of weight cutting in MMA. Hear me out. This is a bit of a side panel. What weight cutting assures is that you are in the best possible shape you can be the day before the fight. You can't mess around in camp. You can't take a day off. You can't only run 5 kilometers one day that you're supposed to run 10. It makes you be the most disciplined version of yourself possible. We can both agree on this. When you lose that side of your camp and when you lose that side of your training, when you're no longer forced to be that disciplined, because now there's no financial incentive to miss weight. You don't have to weigh in at a real amount at heavyweight. You can weigh in to whatever you want to. If de Lima, after being a light heavyweight, was a heavyweight, but he fought at like 230, if he fought at a range that you felt like, okay, if he really got himself together, if he really got it together again.
Like he did on the Ultimate Fighter.
Like he did on the Ultimate Fighter, exactly. That would suggest that, hey, he's not just letting himself go in between camps. He's still being professional. He's just not doing this significant weight cut associated with fighting at 205. But when he does start weighing in at these like 260, 265 weight cuts, like it's pretty concerning for a guy who wasn't even a tall, light heavyweight. It's just whenever you have a fighter move from 170 to 185 at the end of their career, we get nervous. Like Johnny Hendricks made that difference, and it looked like it was huge. Marcos Rogério de Lima is making that weight cut times three.
Well, I mean, like I could throw it over and you could make it like into a backhand, a compliment. You could make it nice, like that George Strait song, you know, how it starts. And then he goes, let herself go on a singles cruise to Vegas once, then to Honolulu. I honest to goodness, I'm going to out myself. I don't like George Strait all that much. Listen,
really?
Jackson, Mark Chestnut, even, but George Strait, I've never been a giant fan. However, the one knock on Ben Rothwell is that he doesn't fight with a ton of output sometimes. Like, really, I look at his overall body of work. Maybe it was a little bit too much too soon. His last knockout loss, Matt, was at UFC 104, Machida versus Shogun, when Cain Velasquez finished him. And what, like a year and a bit ahead of that, he got knocked out by Andre Arlovsky. Since then, he's fought Mark Hunt. Hunt didn't knock him out. He knocked out Brenton Schaus. Do you know that guy?
He knocked out the Ream, Alistair?
Brenton Schaus? Anybody? He beats Matt Mitrione. He beats Josh Barnett with that crazy submission. JDS didn't knock him out. Blagoy didn't knock him out. Arlovsky didn't knock him out the second time they fought. So I go through this overall body of work. The biggest thing that I can give you as a positive from both guys, one, from Ben Rothwell. He's in it from the first second of the fight to minute 14:59. Always in that fight. Because he is such a tricky fighter. And yeah, he might train at a Rothwell MMA. But look at his last fight. Chris Barnett tries to land a couple of blitzes early in the first round. And then Ben takes him down and holds him down until Barnett, to his credit, gets up right at the end of the round. Awesome. Second round, Barnett's really tired. Rothwell catches him in the go-go choke and finishes him. Nobody has these front chokes that Ben Rothwell has. Look at that. I go back and I sit there. It's like, you know, Kermit the Frog with the Lipton. Like, I sit there and I just smile on my porch and I watch Ben Rothwell submit Josh Barnett with that choke that he had. I love going back and watching that. Now, I'm talking like I'm this big Ben Rothwell guy. I'm not necessarily, because again, he's not very flashy. He doesn't really tend to knock a lot of guys out. It's usually a war of attrition.
He's like Jim Miller, but at heavyweight. Like, he just has a style that ages well. He's like Kyle Lowry. He's like Chris Paul. He's like any guy who just really prioritizes technique and the basics over anything else. Because, no, you said it perfectly, though. Like, Ben Rothwell's not a flashy guy, but he doesn't have a single real, like, massive weakness in his game.
No, it's like watching Marco Scudero play baseball. It's like, really? And he did that again? What? Marco? Still doing it, but not anymore. But Matt, yeah, when we look at this one, I'll pop the odds up there really quick. I think finishing ability and the fun aspect is definitely on De Lima. He opened a plus 130 underdog, roughly a plus 127 right now. For Ben Rothwell, the comeback, open minus 150, roughly a minus 154 over there is the average. Over on Tapology, 933 total votes, 85% Rothwell, 54% by decision, 19% by submission, 22% by knockout. For the 15% that have De Lima, 37% by knockout, 41% by decision. I have a hard time seeing De Lima winning this fight by decision. I really do. It's got to be like a quick knockout, because if not, Ben Rothwell is to fighting like wet blankets are to anecdotes. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're not. I've never, you know, there's never any good wet blankets, really. But Ben Rothwell is one of those guys. He just slows down the pace. He makes it his type of fight. And I see that this being that type of fight. He's not Ben Sassoli.
No, Ben Rothwell is really interesting because he's always been a gatekeeper. It's just kind of been at a different level at different stages throughout his career. Like at one point, he was the gatekeeper to the top five. If you beat Ben Rothwell, you yourself were then considered elite. Then it was okay. If you beat Ben Rothwell, you're a good heavyweight, but maybe not a great heavyweight. Now it's if you beat Rothwell, you might be able to get into the rankings. Like, I don't want to say like the Dustin Jacoby, he's the 16th best guy in the world, but you get the idea. Like Rothwell is in that conversation of, hey, on his best day, can give anyone a really hard fight. And on his worst day, you know, maybe a guy like De Lima could beat him. But this is my big thing. De Lima doesn't really fight like the same guy since he has been up at heavyweight, or at least this version of him. The Ben Sassoli win was nice, but that was just like a close your eyes and throw type of a moment. And that's really the only opportunity I see him winning this fight. If he can land a big shot, which of course he can, he's a really, really credentialed Muay Thai fighter. But it's hard to, like, when your only path to victory is, I'm going to knock out Ben Rothwell, I hope you expect a really, really hard night in the office.
Matt, both of us going with Big Ben Rothwell to get the win in this fight, and you are not going to want to miss it because you want a fight that's all action on paper, Matt. On paper, Max Holloway taking on Yair Rodriguez. I'm so excited about it. Let's throw it on over there. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Couple of fighters that are always down to bang. Coming up this weekend, we have a giant fight between the former featherweight champion Max Holloway taking on the uncrowned champion, the people's champion out of Mexico. We have Yair Rodriguez, and both these guys coming into this fight off of very, very different circumstances, because for Max Holloway, he is coming off of one of the best performances of his entire career, which seems like crazy to say, but you look at his last fight against Calvin Kattar. It was a 5-round main event. It was an absolute war, and you continue to see Max Holloway just rack up these wins where he volume strikes, he throws power, he throws shade at his opponent during the fight, and now he's getting into the habit of talking to the commentary team as he goes. It's almost like he's bored with the sport as he's competing in some of these giant, giant mega fights. So for Holloway, obviously he had those two very, very close fights against Alexander Volkanovski. I won't bore you with the details. Did I watch the fight 49 times? I'm not Luke Thomas. I'm on the northern side of the border. But Matt, when I look at this one, Max Holloway coming off one of the most impressive performances of his career, Yair Rodriguez coming off of a very, very wonderful win, but it was a very, very long time ago. It was a couple of years ago when he fought Jeremy Stephens. It feels like to me it was only last year, but I could say the same thing about his fight with the Korean Zombie. It feels like that was only at last year, that big Denver 25th anniversary card. So Matt, I absolutely love the fight. Again, this is a Fight Night Picks marquee fight. It's a striker's paradise. I have so many things that I can say about this fight. And with that, I hand it off to you. I know you're equally as excited.
In 2019, I remember you said something on this channel, and it just, it was one of the first times we've referred to this in any video. And it was just, oh, if Dana White gave me the ability to make any fight in the UFC, what would it be? I'm not going to lie. The first fight I ever imagined in my mind was this one right here. That's how excited I am for this weekend's main event, because a lot of people forget, and I'm going to give us like a beef history here. So we're going to go back a little ways. When Max Holloway had initially won the featherweight title, I think it was 7-Eleven had run like this UFC-inspired Big Gulp type of a promo where on the outside of their cups, they just had like UFC champions on. It was just like, it was a promo piece, you know. Max Holloway wasn't actually the champion they chose to be on the cup. They chose just contender Yair Rodriguez. Now, Max Holloway tweeted out about that and it, like a picture of it. And it was like, oh, this is really funny. This happened years ago, though. I'm really surprised I remember this. So this is kind of like, this is more personal for Max Holloway, I think, than people realize. Because when Max was champion, he wasn't really marketed as well as people like him now. Like, it's kind of weird. He almost, like, he wasn't that popular when he first got the belt, was very exciting afterwards, and then everybody liked him. The UFC was really trying to build up Yair Rodriguez as their next golden boy in the featherweight division. Like, people have to go all the way back to 211 when he got his ass kicked by Frankie Edgar, but he was the favorite going into that fight against Edgar, and I think I thought he was going to win. I knew a lot less about MMA back then, too. But still. Yeah, like the hype was real around Rodriguez. He was supposed to be the next in line for the title that Holloway himself had already held. And it was one of those weird situations where we treated Rodriguez like he was the prospect and Holloway like he was the more established champ. When you look at their ages, they're both only 29. Like, I know Holloway's about a year older than him, but you get what I mean. Like, they are very close in their age, although it feels like Holloway has done so much more throughout his MMA career. And it really is unfortunate that Rodriguez hasn't been able to stay consistent the last, like, 3 or 4 years. Because, listen, would he beat everybody in the top 15 every single fight with his style? Because he is so flashy, I'm sure he's going to get tired in some fights because of the way he strikes. Yes, but we almost kind of robbed ourselves the ability of seeing him go like 7-3 against the top 10. Wow. Because it's a real big disservice, because with Rodriguez, there's a way I can sell his game to where he beats up the front leg of Max. He keeps this at kicking range, not at boxing range. And he can actually really frustrate Holloway on his entries and in the open space throughout the cage. But the problem is he hasn't really been able to show it these last 2 years. So even if I do think he's been able to make those improvements with his overall game, I can't really point to any singular performance throughout the last 700 days. So it's kind of like the Covington Usman argument, where it was, even if you think Covington's made improvements since their first fight, he hasn't been in there to show those improvements off. That's kind of the thing with Rodriguez. Even if you think he's a much better version than the fighter who fought Jeremy Stephens, you can't point to any single fight to prove it.
So have we not talked publicly about that? Why not? Right. Yeah. Huh. I don't think he's going to fight soon. You're supposed to say, is he hurt? And then I say, no.
Is he hurt? And then, what's going on?
Then you say, does it have to be so mysterious? And I say, we didn't announce it. I don't know why we didn't. But yeah, I don't know what the deal is. It's actually none of my business what's going on there. So when it comes out, it will come out. Matt, remember that when Dana White was talking about Yair Rodriguez and he was being super cryptic about it? Has Yair Rodriguez fought since then? No. Did you even recognize the quote? No. That was back in November of last year. That was this time really? Last year. Yeah, that's how long ago. Oh my goodness.
That feels like it was 2 months ago.
The activity for Rodriguez, though, 2014, he fights Leonardo Morales, UFC 180. He wins the Ultimate Fighter. Beats Charles Rosa, 2015. Dan Hooker, 2015. Andre Feely, 16. Casera, 16. BJ Penn, 2017. Loses to Frankie Edgar, 17. Takes about a year and a half off. Beats Korean Zombie. Takes a year off. Fights Jeremy Stephens. Fights him again a couple months later. That was, October 2019. He was booked against Zabit. He fractured his ankle. He was booked against, well, this fight was already booked in July. And then he had that weird, where do we go now? Like Guns N' Roses moment. And I know, you know, extenuating circumstances. I'm not even going to talk about them. I'm just going to say we've been robbed of one of the most exciting fighters' primes, just like his former opponent he was supposed to get, Zabit. Same thing.
The good news, though, is he still only is 29 years old. Like, if he beats Max Holloway, could you imagine? Like, this is what I mean. Max Holloway is such a good fighter that Yair Rodriguez is a plus 400 in a fight. I never thought Yair Rodriguez would be a 4-1 underdog. Like, if he fought Robert Whittaker, I thought he might have these kinds of odds. I didn't think anybody in the featherweight division would ever be this big of a favorite, but that just speaks to the type of fighter Max is in the division. It was really interesting. I'm just going to say this. Luke Thomas was talking about, like, oh, who his, like, Hall of Fame fighters would be in the UFC. And there's not very many of them right now. But Max Holloway is one of the few guys who is still in his prime, still probably has a lot to do in the sport. But it still feels like he's already accomplished enough to be one of the greatest fighters in the sport's history.
100%. And it's unfortunate because he somewhat gets overshadowed by McGregor beating Aldo. And, you know, obviously Jose Aldo, greatest featherweight of all time. So I really do think about him that way, but Max Holloway, if he continues to win, if he's able to beat Volkanovski down the road in a trilogy, who knows? But you're right. You bring up the odds. Holloway opened a minus 375 right now. The public's like them so much that he's up to a minus 608. Rodriguez opened a plus 300. He's a plus 435. Yeah, again, if you asked me about this fight like 3 or 4 years ago, I would have said, Jesus, neck and neck. It's dead even. It's crazy to look at it that way. You look at the stat line again. Who's fought more recently, who throws a lot more volume. With Holloway, his strikes landed per minute, they're way above and beyond what you have out of Yair Rodriguez, who's more of a power shooter. But if you look at it for Holloway, 7.26 significant strikes landed per minute to 4.33 for Rodriguez. Holloway does absorb more at 4.58 to the 3.13 for Rodriguez, but the defense and the accuracy are up just barely a tick for Holloway in his favor. 84% takedown defense from Holloway. And again, for Rodriguez, where are we training out of now? Looks like Valley Flow Striking Systems, where you have great coaches there, and we've talked about the gym there. I mean, I'll throw one name in. Chile's Ignacio Bahamondes is a guy that trains there. Perfect guy to get ready for a certain fight like this. A guy that can use his length and his reach and whatnot. Similar to the way that Holloway's able to do it. Izzy Martinez, yep, you're right. And he spent time at the BMF ranch. He spent time at, Jackson Wink maybe in the past too, same region, same area. Like, we could really point to different gyms, so on and so forth. But for me, again, you got to prove it to me. You got to be active in the cage. That's just the thing that, again, a minus 600 line on Max Holloway feels really silly. But again, he's one of the greatest fighters of all time. And he's only ever lost to some pretty good guys.
Max is like the Wilt Chamberlain of MMA. He really is. Like, we're going to look at his significant strike numbers at a certain point, like down the road, and they're going to be so far ahead of the next closest person that we're going to be like, okay, what was he actually doing in his fights? Because the volume striking that he's able to put out is ridiculous. He's already landed the most significant strikes in UFC history, and he's still in his prime. Like, he could have 10 more fights.
Yeah.
Now,
so you're telling me that in 1983-84, in 70 games, Mario Lemieux had 282 points? I'm sorry. What? Like, that's possible? It's the same deal.
Exactly. We're, like... Your kids won't believe the type of numbers that Max Holloway used to put up. It's going to be wild. But this is the thing. Yair Rodriguez, I think, is a more dangerous fight than Francis Ngannou. Now, I know that's a ridiculous thing to say. Hear me out, please. With Francis, you know what you have to worry about. It's the left uppercut. It's primarily punches. Like, you know that any of them could put you away with just one, but you at least can understand what threats are coming your way. With Yair, he is one of the rare few where it's, how do you get a read on him if he doesn't even know what he's going to do next? We said this about Corey Sandhagen and his fight against Piotr Jan, and he started to tire down as that fight progressed, and we saw what Jan was able to do. I think this fight's going to be very similar to that one. I could see Yair having a good first round, even having a decent second round, because I think Rodriguez is underrated boxing, for being honest. I think he might be able to get a couple shots in on Holloway, but the problem is, when you're fighting a kicker, the primary goal is to crash the distance and not give them time to set up their kicks. Who crashes distance better than Max Holloway in the UFC? Nobody. There is not a single fighter.
Kyle Bochniak.
Kyle Bochniak. Like, normally guys pressure you with their wrestling or their clinch, and that's how they pressure guys forward. Holloway's like Vasily Lomachenko. He pressures you with a threat of violence. And I know that sounds like I'm being dramatic, but it's the truth. He's pressuring you with his striking, and he's also really elusive himself. I know he gets hit a good amount just because he gets into crazy fights, but when you actually look at him in the pocket, he's able to get in, land his combination, and get out before you can respond. Like, even look back at that crazy highlight from the Cater fight. Cater's a really, really good MMA boxer. Max Holloway hits him with a no-look right hand that breaks his nose, misses like seven punches away from him, circles away, and then resets. Like, he's not only a really technical fighter, he's a fan-friendly one too. I don't know a single person that likes MMA and dislikes Max Holloway. Like, listen, we don't cheer for anybody here, I know that, but like, Max Holloway is one of the most aesthetically pleasing fighters to watch in the UFC roster, and I do expect him to do the classic Holloway, put a heavy amount of volume on Yair, probably go to the body a lot. And then I even expect a finish. I don't think Yair has the chin or the durability of Calvin Kattar.
1,048 total votes over on Tapology, Matt. I know what the percentage is already. If 95% Holloway, 42% by decision, 51% by knockout. For the 5% that have Rodriguez, 42% by knockout.
Caleb Plant's a really good boxer, but he boxed one of the greatest fighters of all time his last time out. Yair Rodriguez is faced with a very similar challenge, where he himself is a very good MMA striker, but the problem is we're asking you to do something that, like, very few people can. And this is the thing. The guys who have beat Max Holloway possess two tools that Yair doesn't. Dustin Poirier was able to hurt him on the feet with his boxing. That's something nobody in the UFC can do other than Poirier, probably, because he's a good combination of technique, cardio, and power. And Alexander Volkanovski is so smart that he almost played like the possessions game in basketball or like the time management game in football. He made it less about the fighting and more about what's going on in the cage. Yair, I don't think, has that fight IQ or that power. So that's why I think Holloway is such a big favorite. There's my last.
And game. I mean, it's going to be a weird one, but I mean, if you're a hockey fan, you might dig this one, especially if you're on the West Coast. You look at the Edmonton Oilers and you have two great players, right? Like, 2 year over year MVPs. But who does everybody think about? Who does everybody think about as that flashy guy? You saw him, what was it, last weekend when he scored that goal and he skated around all five guys on the ice while also bringing the puck outside of the zone. I'm talking, of course, of Connor McDavid. And if you look at McDavid, yes, does Yair Rodriguez actually possess some of those qualities? For sure. But Max Holloway possesses those qualities in and of itself, but also the workmanship and the dedication that you need to get stuff done in that octagon. So for me, I'm gonna go with the guy who's just been there, gone consistently to the well, and fought those upper echelon guys that pose those challenges. And oh, by the way, if we want to play that game, how did Frankie Edgar make out when he fought Max Holloway?
Got out volumed really bad and got all of his takedowns defended.
Yeah, so Matt, for me, going with Max Holloway. For yourself, going with Holloway. If you disagree with this, you let us know down below in the comments section. It was an away game for me. setting up in an undisclosed location. But Matt, I'm really looking forward to it. It's a great card coming up this weekend. Of course, we have question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims. Last weekend's episode, because of you, the fans out there listening on the podcast, out there, Spotify, iTunes, tuning in every week on YouTube, tossing us a like, all that stuff. It really does grow the channel. It goes a long way and it really does help us out. So we certainly appreciate you. I just want to say that from me to you. I know Matt echoes those sentiments. When you're helping out the sponsors, you help us out, all that jazz. But really, at the end of the day, I just want to thank everybody out there for making this an awesome show, because it's something that I look forward to coming back every single week. People might look at some of these fight night cards and go, Leah Letson's fighting Felicia Spencer on a main card. Why should I get excited about that? I try to get you excited. I really do. And I get myself excited about these fights. So hopefully that shows through. You enjoy this week. And Matt, I can't wait for question mark kicks on Saturday.
Have a great week, everybody.
All right. Well, keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
Let's get into it.